The stage is in darkness and clear. We're raising the curtain, and no one's quite certain who's played it. Listen then, if we'd known just how right we were going to be. For we dreamed a lot, and we schemed a lot, and we tried to sing of love before the stage fell apart.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, April 25th, 2015. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3160, and our participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. That's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the right, top right side. And by the way, we are kind of short this month. We sent a lot of papers out in the past month, and we sent a lot of papers out this month, too. And we just sent another sending out yesterday. And hang on, we got some noise here. And so we're really short on funds. So those who are not giving, if you can give $5 a month or more, appreciate it. Or those who would like to give, a one-time donation, that'd be good too. You can go to our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website and find the information. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be Joshua chapter 6, verses 1 through 20. You know, the courts have built a wall of resistance against the common law. And we just heard recently from secondhand, we heard that the, I believe it was the lawyers representing the Bundys, they became aware of us, of course, because we did habeas corpus, and they wanted to get word out to let everyone know, hey, by the way, you know, common law is no longer available. They built the resistance up, and it's a wall of resistance. Lawyers believe that. You know, I say if a lawyer makes that kind of a statement, you need to ask him what that means, the Constitution is no more, you know, or what? Because the Supreme Court is quite clear, and that, you know, the Constitution could not be understood outside of the common law. After all, we have unalienable rights, which is common law. Obviously, our Constitution and our Bill of Rights are common law documents. Okay, anyway, that's why I'm reading Joshua tonight, because they have built a wall of resistance, and we are sounding a trumpet. We're going around them and sounding the trumpet. We're bringing truth, and we keep bringing it and banging on their door and banging on their door, and by God's will, these walls will fall. Okay, Joshua chapter 6, and by the way, the Ark of the Covenant brings the law of God. That's what's inside the Ark of the Covenant, for those who don't know. Okay, the fall of Jericho. Now, Jericho was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out, and none came in. And the Lord said unto Joshua, see, I have given into thine hands Jericho, and the king thereof, and the mighty men of valor. And ye shall compass the city, all ye men of war, and go round about the city once. Thus shall ye do for 6 days. And the seven priests shall bear before the ark seven trumpets of ram's horns. And on the seventh day ye shall compass the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow with the trumpets. And it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sounds of the trumpets, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat, and the people shall ascend up every man straight before him. And Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priest and said unto them, take up the ark of the covenant, and let 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of Jehovah. And he said unto the people, pass on and compass the city, and let him that is armed pass on before the ark of Jehovah. And it came to pass, when Joshua had spoken unto the people, that the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns passed on before Jehovah, and blew with the trumpets, and the ark of the covenant of Jehovah followed them. And the armed men went before the priests that blew the trumpets, and the rearward came after the ark, the priest going on and blowing with the trumpets. And Joshua had commanded the people, saying, ye shall not shout, nor make any noise with your voice, neither shall any word proceed out of your mouth, until the day I bid you shout, then shall ye shout. So the ark of Jehovah compassed the city, going about it once. And they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priest took up the ark of Jehovah, and the 7 priests, bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns, before the ark of the Lord, went on continually and blew with the trumpets. And the armed men went before them, but the rearward came after the ark of Jehovah, the priest going on and blowing with the trumpets. And the second day they compassed the city once, and returned unto the camp, so they did 6 days. And it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose up early about the dawning of the day, and compassed the city after the same manner 7 times. Only on that day they compassed the city 7 times. And it came to pass on the seventh time, when the priest blew with the trumpets, Joshua said unto the people, Shout, for Jehovah hath given you the city, and the city shall be accursed, even it and all that are therein, to the Jehovah. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all that are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And ye, in any wise, keep yourselves from the accursed thing, lest ye make yourselves accursed, when you take of the accursed thing, and make the camp of Israel a curse, and trouble it. But all the silver and the gold and the vessels of brass and the iron are consecrated unto Jehovah. They shall come into the treasury of Jehovah. So the people shouted when the priest blew with the trumpets. And it came to pass, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straightway before him, and they took the city. Joshua chapter 6, verses 1 through 20. Anyway, I liking what we are doing with our papers. We're bringing the law of God, the law of the land. We're bringing the law, and we are blowing, and we're blowing that trumpet. And it's going to take at some point in time, and I think it's very close, when we reach that point where we start to have that critical mass. That's when we're going to get in. We're also working with the sheriffs. We've talked about that, and we're very, very close to really starting to communicate with them in a literal sense, by phone or conference call. And we're hoping that we're going to be moving in soon to do something, but we'll see what happens. You know, the timing is not in our hands, but it surely is close. let's see. Tonight, I'm going to read a paper. I was debating on whether we wanted to read it or not. We did post it. We sent out a message. I know Jan sent out a message to everyone to let everybody know that we posted a new paper. It's up on our news page. Just click on news. You can scroll down a wee bit, and it's under the title Federal Court Filings, The Line in the Sand. And you'll see a list down there right underneath that, right above the Lavoie Finicum video. And it's dated for today. It's April 25th, 2016. And it is titled Report of Subversion. You know, over the past 3 years, we've had our problems with people trying to infiltrate, people trying to nudge us this way or that way, people trying to convince us to go early, to do this, to do that, we got to go now, and so on and so forth, and we resisted them all, because we knew we had to do certain things. We had to get people, we had to, first of all, build a coalition across the nation, and get a reasonably good number of people, and people in every state, And so in that process of time, we spend time teaching people, and people are learning about common law and the court process and jurisdiction and different things. And also gathering together other people and bringing it to the vote within their counties for the people to come together to say yay or nay concerning the return to common law grand juries. Of course, it only takes one person to say yay, and you got one. It doesn't matter if 1,000 people say nay, because it's an unalienable right. We're not a democracy. We're a republic. But it was pretty much, you know, almost 100% every time. Most of the times it was 100% of the people. Once we introduced them to the grand jury, the common law grand jury, and the power and the authority of the people that they need to step up and take it, it was overwhelming across the nation. And so we've spent a lot of time to do what we had to do, and now we're at that point in time, we've met principle over and over and over again, and now it's to move forward. Now we're just waiting for that, whatever it takes for us to make that move. We are ready to go. And so whatever it is that happens, then that's when we'll enter into the courts. But there are forces, of course, trying to stop us from doing that. We've had to put up papers at least on 3 or 4 occasions where we would write papers basically, you know, correcting. I'm looking for, hold on. Let me see what, can't find my notes here. Well, anyway, we were denying those things that people were doing that were going to get us into trouble. So we wrote papers and we posted them. And you could find some of these papers, for instance, on the right side hand side of our page. We still have a few of them up there. If you come down, you'll see, disclaimers was the word I was looking for. We had to write disclaimers. So there's the hybrid papers disclaimer, and then there was a press release disclaimer. We had to also do another disclaimer, which we don't have up here right at the moment. We took it down, but because it really made the people who were trying to take us in a different direction, it really made them look really bad. And I thought, well, maybe we just shouldn't leave it up there. But we had to have it up there because we had to have the people to know the truth, what was going on. And these people were saying one thing, and we were saying it was something else, and it so happens that we record all our conversations. We usually delete most of it. But if it's an important conversation, we want to, take notes on it or to share it with others, then we have it. And so those conversations were recorded, and it proved who was the liar on this. And again, we did take those down. But in any event, we were very concerned some time ago for this group that is going out there, particularly making themselves judges and marshals and so on, and that's subversion against the United States of America. And by law, we are required; otherwise, we would be guilty of subversion ourselves, participating it with it. We would be if we have knowledge of treason, and if we don't disclose it immediately. Because this is the law. If we don't disclose it immediately to some judge or to president or governor, then we stand to face, how much time in jail? 7 years in jail and a fine, or both. Well, recently we were approached by these same people, different people, but same group, and they were talking of violence. And we know that that's where they want to try to get us on. We're not going to be going and getting involved in any kind of violent act. That's not what we're doing. We're coming in with the power of the pen, the power of the word, the power of common law. And we're going to take this nation back by the pen, Lord willing. And so we just have to do the right things. But in any event, they said that they were moving forward. That they were going to start to arrest people, okay? And they were going to get the militia as an enforcement. And I have no idea where they were planning to trial these people or to house these people. Obviously, they were not going to be using the courts and the county jails. Well, once they told us that, they moved our hand. We didn't have a choice, and that's what was the purpose of this paper. We would be facing potential jail time or subversion. We'd be subverted ourselves by not reporting it. We had to report it, so we did. Also, to protect our membership, because that's not what we are. We've been very, very careful to be 100% lawful, 100% upfront. There's nothing we do that we don't do in the light. We do everything in the light. And whatever papers we send into any courts, all the marshals get it. All the FBI gets it, the sheriffs get it, the governors get it, all the judges, everybody gets it. About 30,000 plus or minus elected individuals. So we're letting everybody know what we're doing. And we're only doing one thing. We're demanding that they obey the law. Nothing big about that. We would think that they should be obeying the law. We certainly are obeying the law. We expect them to. Okay, anyway, I'm going to read these two papers. I've been debating the pages. I've been debating it, and I think we should read it. And I also debated on whether we were going to talk much about this tonight. But I decided let's do this because we got to get it out there. And it is what it is. Okay, again, it's on the news page, nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on news, scroll down, and you'll see the line in the sand. And then just click on the last one on that list. It says 60425, report of subversion. Okay, this went out to all 94 federal district courts today. It's already been faxed out to every sheriff, every marshal, and every FBI agent in America as we speak. That's done. We're now in the process of faxing it out to other elected individuals, so I believe that's moving through the pike as we speak also. But we mailed this to all 94 federal district courts, and we mailed it also by mail, U.S. Postal. We also mailed it to every governor. And it starts off with a title, Information. The power of the grand jury is to write true bills of indictment, true bills of presentment, and true bills of information, herein the purpose of this paper, and to file such bills in Article III courts, also known constitutionally as common law courts. It is the constitutional duty of the judiciary, elected county sheriffs, and the appointed United States Marshals to act upon such bills. On February 22, 2016, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, hereinafter the UUSCLGJ, filed information in all 94 federal district courts, reporting that agent provocateurs have been fueling a quasi-shadow government movement that essentially advocates the overthrow of the government. A PDF copy can be found at nationallibertyalliance.org/RICO, titled 16-02-22, which is February 22nd, 2016, Information Court 94. So you can get a copy of that. It's only three or four papers up to read that paper, so we reference that paper in this paper. De facto Judge Anna Von Ritz and de facto Judge Bruce Doucette are two leaders who have taken on these self-appointed de facto titles, which also includes governors, marshals, postmasters, etc. It is perceived that de facto Judge Bruce Doucette and de facto Captain Carl P. Koenigs have aligned with Joaquin Mariano Demetria Folish, however you pronounce his name, who titles himself God's Graced Administrator, and Roger Dowdell, who together claim the forming of a grand jury for indictments and arrests of elected and appointed officials. These individuals have duplicated the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury seal and fraudulently evidenced themselves by impersonating the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury for appearance of standing in order to move their agenda forward, to discredit and thereby jeopardize the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury's lawful and honorable reputation and purpose. So one of the problems we have with these people is, you know, they look just like us. And I don't think they really even hide the fact that people think or mention, you know, things. They take that on because we're giving them, you know, a platform. We're giving them a springboard. And this becomes very dangerous. So some of the news media out west during all of the activity going out there earlier on in Oregon actually related and presumed some of these people to be us. And that was a danger and a huge problem for us. And that was one of the reasons why we wrote the paper on February 22nd and filed it with the courts. Because we certainly are not going to be going to the jail for the things that these people are doing. They're not us. We're not them. All right, let me go back. Let's see where we were at. Okay, Joaquin and Roger Dowdell are disgruntled former members of National Liberty Alliance, administrators for the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. In other words, National Liberty Alliance, NLA, is an administrator for the grand jury, who were removed because of their radically distorted view of common law and Joaquin, in the name of the common law grand jury, filed without due process, liens against our elected and our appointed servants. A copy of a disclaimer concerning this issue, titled Hybrid Papers Disclaimer, can be found in the right-hand column at nationallibertyalliance.org. The National Liberty Alliance, or the NLA, has been hearing rumors from the militia plans to provide enforcement for this quasi-shadow government by commencing arrests of elected criminal individuals. It is unknown where they would detain such persons for trial. NLA immediately sent warnings to all militias, advising them not to involve themselves in such unlawful activities, that such actions would be dishonorable and subversive of the United States. It is the duty of the sheriffs and the marshals to perform those duties. We are unaware of any militia moving forward on said plan. About a week or so, it doesn't seem that the militia is moving in with them. We haven't heard anything of that nature. We've heard of some people who claim to be militia, and we're starting to realize that, you know, these people are just saying that. They're not. So these people are provocateurs. That's the only thing I could think of. About a week ago or so, National NLA leadership was approached via phone call by Captain Carl P. Koenigs, who it appears has been wooing NLA leadership for subversive purposes. In an effort to nudge the unified United States common law grand jury to provide to the quasi-shadow government movement indictments against elected and appointed servants in Oregon, so that said movement could then utilize the militia presumed under the leadership of Captain Call to arrest, which is to kidnap, said servants and house them in undisclosed places. NLA rejected the diabolical plan immediately and advised Koenigs that he should cease and desist from any such unlawful action activities. Captain Call appears to have rejected NLA's counsel and appears to be proceeding without the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. This action, and that would have taken him to Joaquin, which we would presume is working with Roger, and we presume that they would do their, they call together these grand, and I doubt that, well, I question whether they actually do pull 25 people together. But in any event, they apparently run a grand jury and are going to go do the indictments for these people. That's our presumption. And use the seals that we designed and to look just like us. And we want to make sure that that blame of that subversive action against our government is not pointed at us, we the people. And that's why we filed these papers. And that's why we filed the papers last time. And that's why we filed disclaimers, so we don't get lost in those things. So anyway, hang on 1 second. Okay. Anyway, let me see where I'm at here. Okay, yeah, so we file these papers because we're not going to take, they're setting us up is what's really happening. And if they're not setting us up, then they're just a bunch of useful idiots. They haven't got a clue in what they're doing, and they don't understand the dangers of what they're doing, and that we're going to have to pay for it with them. It's not us, and we need to make sure everybody knows that. They're in the reason of this paper. Okay, so let me finish reading this. So we told him that he should cease and desist from any other such unlawful activities. Captain Call appeared to have rejected NLA's counsel and appears to be proceeding without the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. This action by Koenigs and our knowledge of its subversive nature require by duty and law that the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury report immediately to some governor or judge such knowledge, which is the purpose of this information. 18 U.S.C. 2382, misprision of treason. Whoever owing allegiance to the United States and having knowledge of the commission of any treason against them conceals and does not, as soon as may be, disclose and make known the same to the president, or to some judge of the United States, or to the governor, or to some judge or justice of a particular state, is guilty of misprision of treason, and shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 7 years or both. The court, April 25th, 2016, signed by the grand jury foreman. Now, this is the reason for our paper. This is why we filed this paper, because of that law. And that in itself may have been a setup to see whether what we would do with that, because if we didn't do this, now that we had that knowledge, we would be susceptible to arrest. And so we didn't want our leadership to get arrested for something that they would be trying to set us up for. Anyway, we want to be very, very careful what we do from this point forward, because they're going to try to take us down. There are agent provocateurs out there. Don't fall for anything. Be wise as has the Bible say, wise as serpents, but as gentle as lambs. Be careful you don't get set up. Let's just do our job. Let's do what has to be done. Let's do the right thing. It doesn't get any more difficult than that. Every moment and every day we have decisions. Just make the right decision. Do the just thing. Okay, anyway, that brings us to the end of that. Before we move on to our guest speaker, who's been visiting us for quite some time, and he's become a regular with us, it will be Brent Winters, the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. Before we move over to him, Gary, are there any questions out there or that have come in through email? Or?
Yes, we do have questions.
What do we have?
All right. Okay. The question is written exactly as I'm going to read it. Lawful versus legal, what is the difference? Are we a country of laws or legalese? That's the question.
Well, the word legalese obviously is a play on that which is legal, and they twist things around, and it's just mumbo-jumbo. They refer here and refer there. They never come out to say anything very directly. And that's what legalese is all about. It's very difficult to understand, very confusing, and it's written that way for that purpose. And they hide their statutes in there in order to deceive the people and defraud the people. But being legal or being lawful is the same thing. You know, I know people say, let's do the lawful thing, not the legal thing. Or there's a few other kind of statements that people might make, but there's no difference. Lawful and legal are the same. What they are doing is not legal. They are having statutes that they're holding up as the law of the land, and that's a fraud. It has nothing to do with being legal or anything. So their unlawful laws are illegal, not legal.
Okay. The last question is, how does a judge, what formula does a judge use to determine if you qualify to file as indigent, as a poor person, in forma properis?
Yep.
This person is curious as to, is there a formula?
Is there a formula for what now?
That a judge uses to determine if you qualify to file as an indigent, poor person, a pauper.
Right. Well, first of all, justice shouldn't cost anything. The courts, I know the federal courts, I think, charge $405 or $400 to get into the courts. The New York State Supreme Courts, they charge $320, something like that, to get into their courts. The United States Supreme Court has ruled numerous times that we're not to pay for justice, so there should be no cost. You don't have to file any papers to say that you're indigent or any of these things. You file papers and you file what's called a file on demand, and then you have to make the battle with these people. And and if you don't know how to go through this part of the process and you don't know how to really keep your jurisdiction and understand common law, you're going to get in trouble in there and you're not going to be able to get through it. So if you don't have to go to court, don't go. Wait until we get to the other side of things. If you're being pulled into court, do whatever you have to do to stay out of jail. That's the key thing. If people are heading to jail and they're concerned with that, they can do a habeas corpus through us. They can petition the grand jury for a habeas corpus. And then we'll do what we can for them. Even with a lawyer or advice, it's not required under common law that you get anyone that is a bar attorney, especially, And that's the worst thing you can get because they don't know anything about the common law. They say common law has been abrogated. But you want to get someone who maybe be a bar attorney that does understand the common law. But you want to get someone to give you advice on the common law. That's very hard to find these days, but people are out there. You know, it's a difficult thing to do. No one should have to file any papers. No one should have to pay money to go into a court of law. That's our unalienable right. Go ahead, Rod.
Well, what she's specifically asking is, what does it take for them to give you a court-appointed attorney for free? And I can answer that because I've experienced this. And the judge has vast leeway. I'm sure there's guidelines out there that say you have to meet certain income statements, you know, just like if you went for Medicaid or welfare or food stamps. Of course, they're going to check you. You know, there's a number there somewhere. Do the judges follow it? I'll tell you right now, absolutely not. I know of cases where a particular woman was a head nurse in a hospital, and she ended up in family court with her live-in partner fighting over a kid, and they appointed her a court-appointed attorney. There's no way she would have qualified for a court-appointed attorney. But apparently they have leeway. Apparently there's monies there that family court says give it to them or whatever they're doing, but, you know, they're doing all kinds of illegal stuff. And if the judge doesn't want you to have a court-appointed attorney, guess what? He won't assign you one. And I don't know what to tell you about that. If you're not working and you know, and he refuses you to, I suppose you can fill out paperwork. There is guidelines. But like I said, nobody's making the judges keep to those guidelines. So if you think that he's refused you unjustly, then you need to fill out a complaint, you know, with the Judicial Review Board. And I think that you could even call up legal aid, because those attorneys that are there will advise you what the guidelines are, and they can't lie to you. So in other words, you go to the I forget what they call the court appointed attorneys, but there's usually a head attorney that runs all of them in a county. And I wouldn't ask the judge. I would go there and ask them, and that's your answer. So, you know, but I do know that the judges are taking lots of leeway in what they do as far as appointing attorneys and not appointing attorneys. And I hope that helps you. Okay, I yield.
Hey, any other questions?
Nope, that's it.
Okay. I have one thing here I don't know if you want to mention on this call, but I just think it's ludicrous, and I want to bring it up because we get these from time to time, and we should answer them, and at one point we said we were going to answer them with a team, maybe a form letter, but I got one here from the District Court of Arizona, Sally A. Arvizu, United States District Court, District of Arizona, has been receiving unsolicited facts from your organization for numerous months. We are requesting that numbers in the range of blah, blah, blah through blah, blah, and including be removed from your distribution list. And in bold capital letters, this is a federal court and your fax transmissions need to cease immediately. Well, look at who does she think she is and who does she think we are? And we should answer this. And there is a phone number. Maybe we should just call her, John. But this is a
phone call. I don't know about a phone call. I mean, we could, but you know, I think it is best to answer by letter.
Well, we should have. We had worked on, and I don't know.
Well, why don't you pass it over to Don? Yeah,
Don should.
You know, we got a few here that I was going to answer, and maybe we'll pass them. It's about three of them. Let me pass them all to Don and let him write something up.
Look, you would think by now these federal courts would understand who we are and they would stop putting such stupid requests in. I just want people to know that this is what we're dealing with. Look, we're the people and we're assembling as a tribunal and we're sending the court documents and they're telling us to cut it out. It's bothering them. This is what's wrong with America. You don't bother us. We're too busy messing with the people, you know? Anyway, yes. just so you know what's going on, I yield.
Too busy stealing our money. So
that's right.
All right. All right. Anyway, okay, we're going to move over now to Brent. Brent, are you out there? Brent, *6 to turn your mic on.
Yes.
Okay, there you go. Okay, go ahead, Brent. You've got it.
Thanks, John. after listening to all that, of course, things are racing through my head. And I am taking it all in and trying to evaluate what I'm hearing. I want to say this at the outset, before I get to my subject, that it is my position that as long as the courts are open, then the courts should be used. We don't need to go to the second step or the next step of thinking about any kind of violence. As long as the courts are open, I take that on the authority of Justice Stevens Fields of the Supreme Court, when the President of the United States, a fellow by the name of Abraham Lincoln, was jailing men without trials and hanging them by military tribunals, or at least trying to, and a fellow in Indiana was jailed, and he was sentenced to hang in Indianapolis by a military tribunal. He appealed his case to the Supreme Court of the United States, and Justice Field wrote that as long as the non-military courts are open, then they should be used. And that's what they weren't doing. That saved his life. He wasn't hung, but he certainly faced that possibility. And as long as our courts are open, and as long as the jury is impaneled, even if it's stacked, as long as it's impaneled. By the way, the common law jury works sometimes even when it's stacked. That's the beauty of the thing. But even if it's stacked, if the courts are open, then the jury is impanelable. That means the machinery is in place, and it's up to the people of the United States to use the machinery. And the way you do that is with words. You petition the government. It's an absolute right under the First Amendment. That's why we have it, so that we can file lawsuits, and we can file motions and writs of requests of, for writs of whatever, habeas corpus, quo warranto, certiorari in an appellate court. And the courts are open. That's what needs to be done. And by the way, they are open, and that's where the fight needs to be. We want to avoid, and the evil empire wants to bring violence upon us, and they want to incite us, and the provocateurs are out there. It was well said, don't be baited and don't get caught up in that. If there's going to be that kind of thing happen, let it happen. Let it happen on its own. Don't be the one that foments it. Our separation from Britain didn't start that way. From all appearances, there was a provocateur. But what we want is peace and law. And we're all about the remedy for, I should say I am, I shouldn't speak for other people, the only remedy for lawlessness, and we face it, lawlessness. The only remedy is law. There is no other remedy. There never has been, and there never will be. So let's learn and keep and do the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. The Supreme Court of the United States, I'm off to my subject now, the Supreme Court of the United States got it right. They said the militia of the several states is an able-bodied subset of the people. The people, that phrase from the preamble of the Constitution. Indeed, America's government is not a government of men. It is a government of law, but just not any law. America is a government of common law, contrary to the opinions, apparently, of law school-educated lawyers in America. They've sucked into the lie. Listen, if there is no common law in America, there is no jury, because the jury is only impaneled in common law countries. It's a creature of our common law. And I could go on and on and on about all the unwritten features of our common law that we seldom think about and isn't written in the books anywhere. The common law tradition. We are a common law country. Say it often and say it loudly if you have to. Just because people are miseducated, and many of them are because they've been to government schools and institutional schools instituted with the powers that be, They're miseducated. Don't say they're not educated. No, they're educated. They're just not educated. They're miseducated. They have been taught the wrong law, and taught the wrong law governs. But in America, our governments, state and federal, at every level, are governments of common law and the heartbeat of our common law. Watch me close. Is the two functions of the ancient militia. It wasn't always called the militia in common law countries. It was called the FIRD, F-Y-R-D. We get our word Fred from that, I suppose, the name. But the heartbeat of our common law is the militia's two functions. And those two functions are separate from any authority received from government. That is the function of jurymen and the function of armed defense. Those are the two functions of what we today call the militia. And that anciently in our English-speaking world was called the FIRD. And to our forebears, forget all the people that are famous that are called our forefathers. Forget those fellows for a minute. Because all they did was echoed what 3 million people in America knew and understood, and they knew if they didn't echo what people were thinking, put it into words, they wouldn't stay in power. That's what being in politics is all about, by the way, is echoing what people want to say, but for some reason don't have a voice to say it. And it is the rank-and-file American, of which there were millions, that made it happen in America. And it's still that way, and it will always be that way. It doesn't mean that the rank-and-file man will get credit. No, he probably won't. Any more than the man that risked his life on the battlefield gets credit. He doesn't get credit. The general officer gets credit for the victory. We've learned that by watching history. That's the way the world works. And it's always worked that way. It's not going to change, but it doesn't change your duty before God. And whether or not you get credit for what you do is of no consequence. Because God's supposed to get all the credit anyway, and you're supposed to get the enjoyment. And if you try to take the credit to yourself, I tell you for sure, you're not going to get the enjoyment. And I've known a lot of famous people that have gotten a lot of credit, and when I saw the end of their life, there wasn't much enjoyment to it. And I've seen it a lot, and I'm still seeing it today, by the way. So be content. Be content to let God get the credit, and you can have the enjoyment. He promises you can do that. But if you're unwilling to give him the glory and the credit, he won't give it to anybody else, and it's just going to cause problems. Well, we have the militia clauses of our United States Constitution, and our forebears were willing to give everything they had for those militia clauses, what they came to be. But there again, the militia clauses of our United States Constitution, all four of them, are a product or just a restatement of the common law standards put in words here in the New World, with the added benefit of our rustic experiences here. And when the men that penned the Constitution did so, and when they signed the Declaration of Independence, they did so with gunpowder, the reek of it, hanging in their noses. And when they put it to paper, all those organic documents, death was facing them, and many of them lost all, lives, liberty, property, combination thereof, because they were outlawed immediately. And to be outlawed at common law is not a pretty sight. In all of the history of Adam's race, only Israel, the nation Israel of old, has enjoyed such a forthright, written, fundamental law respecting the militia, as do us Americans. No people on the face of our planet in the history of mankind has ever enjoyed such a bold set of statements defending, enforcing the right of men to assemble in common defense and in government, the grand jury and the petit jury. And those are the two duties of The militia, friends, neighbors, and relatives, it just is. It's not something that has to be formed. It's not something that has to be organized. It refers, you can go back and read the documents, this isn't a matter of opinion. It's not up for debate. The Federalist Papers even say it, and they were quoting other people. Militia means that body of able-bodied men that are able to carry weapons, usually and in the Bible between 20 years old to 45 about. Mandatory to do so. Well, the militia of the 12 separate tribes of Israel are analogous in the Bible to the militia of the several states. I'm quoting our Constitution, the militia of the several states, and that's why the Supreme Court did get it right when they said that the militia of the several states, they're quoting the Constitution, this is, by the way, in a recent case from 2008, the militia of the several states is an able-bodied set of the people. Well, there are four groups of people, the four militia clauses of our Constitution govern. Four groups. Congressmen, they have a duty, they have duties under the militia clauses of our Constitution. State legislatures, that's group number two. Presidents, that's group number three. And the fourth group is the only group that does not receive its authority from the militia clause that refers to that group. The presidents of the United States, state legislators, and congressmen, all of those, to do their duty, according to the Constitution, receive authority from the Constitution to do so. But that fourth class of people, the people of the United States, the militia themselves, they receive no authority from the Constitution of the United States to do what they do and what the Constitution says they, our common law, says they're supposed to do. And that fourth militia clause of the Second Amendment grants no authorities to nobody. It recognizes a God-given right, recognizes it, and commands and ensures that government will protect it and not interfere with it. What is that right? It is the right of individuals to keep and carry loaded guns. The language of our Constitution is a little different, but that's what it means. To keep, that means to own, to have, and to carry loaded guns. That's the way it plays out in application. The rest of our Constitution, the whoop and wharf of its fiber, the militia clauses hold together. Because out of the militia clauses arise the duties of the juryman, and the only thing that stands between the government and the individual in practical terms. And it's not that the militia threatens the government. No. The militia, it's the presence of the militia that makes government work. The presence. Just like the presence of the people, just we're us just being here, us just talking, us just having the right to petition government, the right to invoke God and to pray. All of those things produce fear in the evil empire. And the evil empire is always going to be here too. And if there's anything they're afraid of, the Bible says it this way, and I see it consistently, they're afraid of people that aren't shaken up or in fear. They themselves are afraid of people that aren't shaken up or in fear. The evil-intended man, he trembles even at the rustling of a leaf, afraid of everything and everybody, his own shadow. If there's anything a government employee is afraid of, number one, it's losing his government job. You wouldn't believe what I've heard people say when they didn't think I was listening. Federal employees, that's why they're there. They have a lust for the security that it offers. They trust in the system. And they're fearful. And we're not supposed to be that way. We're supposed to be relaxed and have the confidence of three things. We gain it by three things. Confidence. What are they? That throws fear out, by the way. That is learning the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. Keeping the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, those two volumes, and doing the duty that the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God charges us to do. Well, these four militia clauses are kind of a surefire, sure-footed array to stop lawlessness and government oppression within while ending the threat of invasion without. To stop lawlessness within and ending the threat of invasion without. And if these four militia clauses are put into practice by these four classes of people, there's no stopping the United States. If we would only do just this one thing, just this Joseph story, said his greatest fear when he wrote his commentaries on the Constitution, 40 years approximately after the Constitution, after the people ratified it. He said his greatest fear was that America would ignore its militia clauses, and that they would do so, he said, if it happened, by inches. I'm not quoting, but that was the idea. It'll sneak up on them, and they'll just gradually ignore them. And that's what's happened. All four militia clauses, three of them, are absolutely and utterly ignored. The congressmen, the presidents, the state legislators and governors haven't done anything for the last 175 years that the Constitution demands them do for their duty respecting the militia. And the power concerning the militia are divided up wisely among those three groups. The only group of people that has fulfilled its duty respecting the militia clause, respecting the recognition of their duty in the Second Amendment, has been the people of the United States. And because they've done so, all that need to be done is for government to obey the law, obey the Constitution of the United States and do their duty. That's why I say to people, it just takes one thing, one thing like this, to encourage state legislators. State legislators don't have a clue about the militia clauses. Who's even heard of the militia clauses? Three of them, we've heard of one of them, the last one, the foundational one, the Second Amendment. But who's heard of the other three? And they're the fellows that are charged. You know, the Constitution puts a duty on state legislators, just as it does the other two groups, congressmen and presidents. And we're going to go over those, Lord willing, in the future. I just wanted to mention them to kind of give a big picture here before we do it. If Lord willing, if I'm able to come back as a guest speaker again, I'll continue where we left off. Well, these militia clauses that put in practice would protect us from our enemies within and without, and to obey our militia clauses is to know our freedom. But to ignore them, said Justice Story, is to forfeit, I'm quoting him here now, to forfeit their strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers. Allow me to repeat that. Justice Joseph Story of the United States Supreme Court says to ignore the militia clauses is to forfeit their strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers. Notice well, he's talking about the arbitrary power of rulers within our own country. He's not talking about primarily rulers without our country, although that's part of the militia's duty as well. But I want to mention one more thing. I have probably enough time to do this, and then we'll quit for today. And that is this. The source of authority. I'd mentioned this a while ago. The source of authority, respecting that clause of our Constitution, the people. It starts the Constitution in the preamble. That means the walking about before the thing starts. The walking about, ambling about, preamble. It just kind of it sets the boundaries on what the Constitution is going to talk about. Very important part of our Constitution, by the way. Somebody said if the preamble of the Constitution were a ring of gold, at the center of that ring would be a suite of jewels. And the biggest jewel in that suite would be the phrase, to achieve domestic tranquility. It says that right about the center there. Domestic tranquility. Why do we defend against foreign invaders? Why do we try to maintain lawlessness and put it down in our own midst? So we'll have domestic tranquility. And right there is the doctrine of our common law called peace. Every kingdom, every nation has its peace. Every executive, every king in a common law country has his peace. And every man has his peace. And to violate that peace is to violate him and is to trample across the image of God in him. That's the doctrine of our common law. And that's why we're a free country, because we're still enjoying, we're operating on fumes at this point. We've run out of gas, because we have been in a swamp and we're not drinking from a running stream. We're not constantly refreshing ourselves and reminding ourselves of God's law of nature, and the laws of nature is God, but the flow of authority goes this way. God. You say, well, which God? Well, the God that made all things, seen and unseen, the Creator, as some put it, the Creator of all things. He is not creation. We are not pantheist in America. God is separate from his creation. He is the Creator, and his creation, his creatures, living or static or something else. God, the Creator, is the wellspring of all true right. That's the old English word, called authority. That's the old Latin word, called jurisdiction. That's the Roman sense put on it. It's all the same thing, right, authority, and jurisdiction. And all three of those, by the way, are duties. Your rights are not something selfish God has given you to defend for yourself. No, it is your duty. That's what the old Germanic word means. Right. Right. Duty. God is the wellspring of all right. That means all, to put it in the Latin and French sense, all authority. That's really a French word. The right and authority. God is the source. That's, by the way, said, 1 Corinthians, Romans chapter 13, verse 1, begins that way. That's the first thing a fellow has to understand government. If you don't accept that, then you will not accept right government and lawfulness. You will be lawless. Well, you say, well, I got law. Well, Sharia law, Babylonian law, Pharisaical law are not lawfulness. That's lawlessness. The people of our Constitution are direct creations of God. And the people is the militia, those able-bodied men of the people, able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle. God is the spring, the wellspring, the ultimate source of all authority. The people are creations of God. We are creatures in that sense. And God gives authority to the people for the creation of governments among men. That's what our Constitution says, we the people of the United States. That authority was given to them according to our Declaration of Independence from the source of all authority. So God is at the top. He dispenses authority. We as creatures have no understanding to go behind him. We don't know what's on the other side. We just know he's the source, and he says so. If he wanted us to know, he'd tell us. He hasn't. God gives authority to the people. They create government, legislative, executive, and judicial powers. The people establish then also the respective states. In our country, that's what happened. And give to these states authority for government. The legislative, executive, and judicial powers. The people then create the government with authority given to them individually, not corporately, no, don't mix this up. The people are not the corporate body. Not at all. God dispenses his authority individually. I know that creates questions, but it all works out pretty right in the end. So the people create the states, the people created, or penned, I should say, our Constitution. They put it to paper. They didn't think of it themselves. They didn't make it out of whole cloth. No, they just put to paper what they understood were the laws of nature, our common law. Our Constitution of the United States, penned by the people in recognition, really, of the laws of God. God gave man the authority to do that, to recognize his law. And our Constitution, through it, establishes the limited, separate, and co-equal branches of our general, that is, our national government. And the three branches of that national government are creatures. Watch me close on this. The three branches of government, the government itself of the United States, is a creation, a creature, as our law says, of our Constitution. Now watch me closer, even now. Our Constitution is a creature of the people. The people of the United States and the militia, that is the people, are not creatures of our Constitution. They are not creations of our Constitution. Government and all that's in it is a creation of our Constitution. Our Constitution was put in place by the people, and the people received their authority individually and directly from God. And our government draws its authority, our national government, from our Constitution. If the government of our Constitution does not give the government, it does not give the government the specific expressed power, then as a matter of law, our government does not have that power. And our government, our national government, is running plumb amok, taking power to itself without authority to do so. And there's a difference. Authority, yes, we say law is that authority. They're saying they have the authority to do it, but they're not. Claiming the power, for instance, to assassinate people all over the world without trial, to jail them forever, throw the key away and forget about them without due process. That's what a trial is, part of due process. Well, in sum, because the militia of the several states of our union is a subset of the people, it is the people. Our Constitution never creates the militia, but rather recognizes it and affirms it. Our Constitution recognizes and affirms the militia of the several states of our Union, and then puts four clauses in place whereby to govern that militia. John Locke, from whom Tom Jefferson is said to have plagiarized much of our Declaration of Independence, indeed, there's no question he did. Jefferson had soaked his brain in John Locke's writings. John Locke was a student of John Owen, Puritan in England. John Locke was a biblicist. He had looked into the Bible with such vigor for so long, people said his blood was bibbing. John Locke said that God has furnished to men, he has furnished to them faculties sufficient to direct them in the way they should take if they will but seriously employ those faculties. What he's saying is men do not know right from wrong without learning right from wrong. But I'm relating more of what he said about this. This is just a quote. He said, men do not naturally know right from wrong. They must be taught or they must learn. But his position was, God has charged every man with knowing right from wrong because God has given every man the faculties, he says here. That means the wherewithal to learn right from wrong. And that's why we're making these presentations. And by the way, I get more out of this probably than anybody listening. Not only do I learn as I talk, I think of things I hadn't thought of before, but it pounds home some of the things that I'd been exposed to before. And I appreciate the opportunity, John, I say that every time, but I really do, the opportunity to unload so I won't, as it were, burst. This is important information. Lord willing, if I am able to come again, I'll start talking about those four militia clauses and pulling them apart and then trying to put them back together. They're simple, but they do need some attention. Who gives it to them? No one. And by the way, if you're interested in following along, I've written a booklet called Militia of the Several States, a primer. It's about 100 pages long. It's not overly complicated, but I think it has information in it that is worthwhile and I believe fundamental to getting our country on the right track, without resorting to the madness that the evil empire, the powers that be, seem to want to bring us to. That is violence. This thing about provocateurs is not small. It's huge. And the government hires men to draw out ones they don't like and then nab them. And they want to incite violence because if you're the biggest gorilla on the block, violence keeps you in power. Anybody challenges you, you have a chance to squish them. And then your power is further established. And if anyone's foolish enough to draw a line and say to the government, step over this line, we're going to have a fight, you have put yourself in their power and you have lost. That's not what you're to do. As a matter of fact, Jesus Christ says in the Sermon on the Mount, don't do that. And then he tells us, and he goes about very specifically to describe to us how to deal with evil in the place of powers that be. False gods, saying that saying that all power has been given to them on heaven and earth by God himself. They'll masquerade any way they can to dominate. Well, John, that's enough, I suppose, for one night. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Brent. You might want to share your website, and I know you have a radio program. Share some information on that. We'll help people can find that.
The website's www.commonlawyer.com. That's commonlawyer.com. And on the homepage, you can see there, I'm on the radio 5-6 days a week, and you can see what times and how to tune in. It's through the Internet. It live streams on the Internet worldwide. Or not, wherever some people here listening in Mexico, they tell me. You can get it down there, too, in this age of when we've conquered time and space, as John Calhoun said we'd do. We did. And now we can do that. We're on this conference call. That's great. That's www.commonlawyer.com. You can also get my books at amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters, and they'll come up. We're going through Magna Carta on the radio now, blow by blow and clause by clause. We're probably about halfway through, and if you're interested in what the common law is, Magna Carta didn't invent the common law. Magna Carta just did like our Constitution. It observed it and said, let's get back to it. And our Constitution lifted language from Magna Carta in many places and said the same thing over again. You can listen to those. I just got word today from the people that sell my book, my comparative law text and the common law, that it's running out the door. I don't know who's buying it. Maybe somebody here is listening, but I was pleased to hear that today because I sat on those books for a long time and nobody seemed to want them, a few here and there. So I didn't want to have to buy them all. Apparently somebody's getting them. But for those who would think, buy a copy and give it to your local judge. I was in a little doctor's office not long ago having a small operation on my face done by a fellow that I thought would do a good job, and I found out he was a local judge. He was a doctor, and he also served as a local judge down at the courthouse. I didn't know that, and I came back to get the stitches out. I gave him my book. It's about, not quite 1,000 pages, Excellence of the Common Law, Comparing and Contrasting the Law of the Land, our common law, with the law of the city. We call it today the Roman civil law, and every continent through history from the days of Babylon, starting with the history of Babylon and its settling and what happened there and moving forward to America, England, and all over the world, comparing and contrasting and what happened and why it happened and the differences, drawing the distinction. Give one to some of these lawyers have been miseducated and told that the common law is no more. That's not true. It will never be true. Because the common law is the recognition of God's laws of nature, the nature of things the way they are. Now, you can find my books there and listen to me on the radio and other things that might be of interest to you.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. All right. We'll have a few people might want to have some questions for you, so we'll open up for the next 15 or 20 minutes for you. Let me move over to the Q&A. Anybody that's got any questions or any comments for Brent? Hit star 6 as soon as we open. Star 6 to get into the queue. Okay, let's take our first question. Let's see. It is, looks like Charles from Michigan. Go right ahead, Charles. You've got the mic.
This is Paul.
Oh,
I think
Paul.
The wrong name is on your screen.
Okay, go ahead, Paul.
Brent, I
what
have your book,
by the way, Paul.
Hunter County, Michigan.
Okay, go right ahead.
Brent, I have your book on the excellence and also clause by clause, and I'm considering purchasing that Bible. My mind doesn't work like it used to, but still, my question is tonight, and I really appreciate all your work. It really helps us. My question is, could you elaborate on the term first principles a little bit? You bring that up different times.
Oh, I like that. And I'm encouraged all the pieces that you read in the book. That's encouraging. I didn't write the book because I wanted to. I ended up writing because I had to. The question was, what are first principles? Our common law is a law of first principles. First principles. That phrase, and it's been said by common lawyers for centuries, that phrase is lifted out of the Bible, the English Bible, Hebrews chapter 5 at the end. I forget what the verse is there, 21 or something, but it's at the end. It's the only place in the Bible the phrase occurs, first principles. A good translation from the Greek text would be unwrought rudiments. Unwrought, I've searched for words that would get this even better because people ask that question, what are first principles? Well, they're unwrought rudiments. Well, what are unwrought rudiments? Well, unwrought means, or wrought, things that, yeah, we had a place at home, a blacksmith for years, old Hap Harthen, and he did a lot of things to try to make a living besides sharpening tools and whatever else he had to do. But he did what he called wrought iron, W-R-O-U-G-H-T, wrought. Well, things that are wrought, that's an old English word, and it means by the hand of man. Wrought, wrought iron, worked by the hands of men. He made the prettiest railings and things. But unwrought means not touched by the hands of man. And unwrought rudiments are those principles that come down from the Creator himself, the source and fountain, the fountain of all right, authority, and jurisdiction, that are delegated from him, not touched by the hands of man. And the writer to the Hebrews says this, the problem with you Christian folks is you love the idea of heaven and God and how wonderful it all sounds. The gospel is a beautiful story, and it's the way you get redeemed and the way you stay out of eternal judgment. It's not by your works, but by God. But he said this, if you want to enjoy this Christian life you now have, you need to go back and learn the unwrought rudiments, the first principles of law. Well, what fundamentally, though, are those first principles? What are those unwrought rudiments? Well, let's start with this, the ten so-called commandments. They're not really commandments. They're not imperatives in the Hebrew text. They're not even imperatives in the English translation. Maybe they're in the English translation, good translation. Most translations say, put most of the Ten Commandments in future indicatives. Thou shalt not kill. You see, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. Those are statements about the future from the viewpoint of the speaker. God's people don't murder people. God's people don't steal. That's what they're really saying. And, of course, you might look at yourself and you say, well, I've stolen things before. I've even thought about killing people before. And that's the whole idea. You look at those first principles and you compare yourself to them. And it should be obvious to anybody who's got any sensibility that I'm not measuring up. It makes me feel guilty. Well, that's the whole point of God's law, number one, is to bring a little guilt on you to straighten up your behavior. Guilt is like, to the soul, is like pain to the body. If you didn't have pain in your body, you'd be in a terrible shape. I knew a lady one time, she still lives in a neighboring town, haven't seen her in years. She didn't feel any pain. I forget what that, it's not a disease, it's a condition. It comes on very few people, but you can read about it. I forget the name of it, but some people can't feel pain of the body. And so when they injure themselves, they don't know enough to stop. And they keep going, and then they injure themselves worse. I read about a guy one time that was playing baseball, and he broke his legs, and he kept trying to run. And before it was over, he had, it just made it a lot more difficult to put the bone back in place. But he had this condition that he didn't feel pain. Well, if you don't feel guilt, if you've gotten to the point you don't feel guilt anymore, you have no motivation to change your behavior. The Bible talks about that, too. It's called having the conscience seared. You can go on in your lawlessness. And by the way, that's what sin is, S-I-N. The Bible defines it, says sin is lawlessness. That means you're not following true law. You're trespassing God's character. You're violating his standards. Well, if you do that, you don't feel guilt, you just keep going, pretty soon you're done. God's law cannot be broken. You can break yourself on it. You're not going to break it. When I talk about the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, when I talk about the first principles, let's say, for example, the Ten Commandments, getting back to that, returning to where I was, the Ten Commandments, all of God's standards are categorical. No, that's not a good word. All of God's law can be categorized under one of the Ten Commandments, if not overlapping two or three or more. Those Ten Commandments are the heading, and those Ten Commandments then, we know, can be divided into two relationship kinds. The second of the Ten Commandments, 6 through 10, have to do with the horizontal relationships among mankind. Covet, lie, steal, commit adultery, and murder. That's the last five of the Ten Commandments backwards. I memorized the Ten Commandments backwards. It's a long story how that happened. I also learned how to play the harmonica backwards when I was 5 years old, and I've never been able to do it the other way around. My brother got me started, and I didn't know any better. And And so it's the same kind of thing. I know the Ten Commandments the other way around, but covet, lie, steal, commit adultery and murder, that has to do with horizontal relationships. The first five of the Ten Commandments has to do with the vertical relationship with God. So love God, love your neighbor. That gets everything. And Jesus said that. Love God, love your neighbor. Upon these two, all the law and commandments and the prophets hang, he says. Well, the love of God, love, L-O-V-E, people say, what is love? I read a book one time, a professor from Southern California University, USC, tried to define love back in the 60s. Ridiculous book. I think the name of it is Love. Well, the Bible tells us, just like it tells us what sin is lawlessness. How clear can it be? The Bible also tells us what love is, God's definition. Love is, this is in 1 John, that you keep the commandments. The commandments, yes, the unwrought rudiments, the first principles. Listen, you can't learn all of the details of every possible application of God's law. That's Babylonian law. That's what they try to do. They have thousands and thousands and thousands of regulations and statutes, try to cover every future contingency that may bob forth from the flux of the relationship of men. Well, our common law doesn't do that. It lays down some general principles, and then it says, oh, when you got a problem, go to the courts. But if you don't have a problem, you're free to do pretty much what you want. We're not going to try to control the future. Courts don't control the future. Legislators control the future. They say, we make this against the law, and it's always in the future. It's always prospective. Our common law courts or common law is just the opposite. It's retrospective. You don't ask the jury what's going to happen in the future. You always ask the jury and the judge what happened in the past and who was right and who was wrong. That's our whole common law system. It's retrospective with a view towards giving guidance to the future. That's beautiful. The common law takes note. Isn't it fascinating that in a common law country like ours, we learn the history? I learned when you go to law school. You learn they used to. They don't teach this anymore. The course isn't even offered. But you learn the history of English law. Yeah, learn its history. You know, in Roman civil law countries, which is almost every other country in the world except the English-speaking world, they don't learn that because history doesn't matter to them. All that matters to them is, in their culture, in their tradition, that they must obey in the future and watch out for the future and don't move unless you have permission. What the legislator says, the legislator could be a dictator. It could be a bevy of men, a combination of men like a legislature. It could be a Politburo like in the communist countries. But somebody's telling you what you can and cannot do in the future. Now, I know that our country does that. We're in a common law. They do that. We're the most regulated country in the world. People say we're not a common law country anymore because of it. That's not true. The common law overlays everything in America. That's why we, as I say, we have juries and we have separation of powers. That's our Constitution. That's common law doctrine. Among many other, right to remain silent. That's from our common law. So that's the unwrought first principles. And the way to understand that, to understand it from the perspective of the Bible, that's where the phrase comes from. It's part and parcel of our common law. Justice Story put it this way, and I like to quote him because he's better known, but a lot of other judges have said it. There never was a time, said Justice Story, never was a time that Christianity, the Bible, did not lie at the foundation of our common law. That is a fact. That's not a philosophy. That's not some theology. That's just a fact. It's just history. There's nothing anybody can do to change it. I like to say to my clients, in a criminal case, you got facts on your side. Forget the law. Forget the philosophy. Forget the criminal statute. You got the facts. And the facts are not some things in a country of common law and with men that have a common law mindset. The sensibilities as Americans, facts are everything. No, they're not some things. They're everything. Philosophy is nothing. Theology doesn't even amount to that much, although good theology is just showing how the Bible makes sense and not nonsense. We can do that with one-step inferences. And it's important that we do it. Most people don't even do that, I found. But facts are everything to our common law. Facts are everything to God. And the truth of the matter, the fact of the matter, is that from which all things, all good reasoning must come. And Paul, the apostle, said, Acts chapter 20, when he left the elders at Miletus, I did not neglect to declare unto you the whole counsel of God. And then he said later, He said, I reasoned to you out of the Bible. Out of the Bible. I didn't reason with you out of some law book. I didn't reason with you, well, out of some man-made code. I didn't reason with you out of the latest philosophy. I didn't reason with you out of the latest movie or the latest piece of literature. That I reasoned with you out of the fact of what God said, the law. The Danes gave us the word law. Log. It means, it related to our word log, L-O-G. It had to do with things that were waterlogged, that couldn't be moved, that were very large, that were unmovable. That's what our law is, fundamentally. It's that which is unmovable. It can't change, won't change. Why? Because the God that gave it, it's his will. He's unchangeable. He never has changed, never will. Hasn't changed his point of view, hasn't changed right from wrong. Well, that's a lot of talk. Sometimes I talk for a while, and I say, well, maybe if I say something else, this will hit the nail on the head, because I don't always know if I'm doing that. Did that address the question?
Yeah, I think so. I had a rough idea, but I just wanted you to elaborate, and that's good. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, Paul, and appreciate you, and hope to talk to you again.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Let's take our next person. It looks like California. Is that Jeremiah?
It is me, yes. How are you tonight?
You've got a lot of background noise or anything.
I do. Why don't you put me on the back burner for calls and bring me back in a little bit later so this noise can die down.
Okay. All right, well, what you might want to do is just get back in the queue in a minute. Actually, the queue is empty at this point. We only had two people coming in.
All right, great. Go ahead
and
take that caller.
Back to you. All right. Okay, 406 number. You got the mic. What's your first name and your state?
My name is Ed, and my state is Montana.
Okay, so Ed from Montana. Do you have a question or a comment for Brett?
Yeah, I'd kind of like to know what is habeas corpus and what is the actual purpose for it.
Well, I'll talk about it a little bit, and then if you have further questions, you can email at commonlawyer.com, and if I can make it clear, habeas corpus is a creature of the Parliament of England. Habeas corpus is a creature of the Parliament of England. It was put in place to try to realize a common law right. It's a piece of machinery has worked real well. It's worked really well in America and England. But the common law right that it's intended to enforce and to make more real to us, more doable, is the right against false imprisonment. The right against false imprisonment. False imprisonment, the common law, is defined as confining a man to a boundary, and it's amazing, and the standard's kind of subjective. It's a good one. It's within the person that's jailed. If a person feels like they can't leave, well, then they're jailed. For example, if a police officer, you know, some people say, well, am I under arrest? No. Well, then I'm leaving. No, you can't leave. Well, am I under arrest, though? Oh, no, you're not under arrest. Well, then I'm leaving. Well, I'm not going to let you leave. Well, that officer is just confused himself for playing games. If you don't feel free to leave, you're under arrest. You are imprisoned. Then the question comes, is your imprisonment false or is it lawful? Lawful or unlawful? And that's what habeas corpus was intended to, it was intended to be the remedy against it. Now, when Magna Carta was penned, the remedy at common law, the common law used this remedy because habeas corpus had never been thought of yet. And I'll tell you more about what habeas corpus is. I'm just giving you a background at first here as to what it's intended to do. It's intended to prevent false imprisonment. Why is false imprisonment so important? Well, the reason false imprisonment is so important is not a man-centered reason. It's not because I don't want to be jailed. It's miserable to be in jail. Well, it darn sure is miserable. I can tell you that from personal experience. It's miserable. You take away, we only got three things in this life. You got life, you got liberty, and you got property. And take away any one of those three, and it's like having the other two taken too. Those three, by the way, they stand and fall together, always. We can distinguish them as different things, but they stand up all together. Take one, you've taken all. If you're in prison, you don't have the right to enjoy your property or your life. Well, anyway, getting back to the point, why is it important? It's not because because men don't like to be imprisoned. The reason the common law that false imprisonment is forbidden is because it mitigates against the duties that God has given to man. The old theologians used to call it the covenants of God. What are the most fundamental covenants of God? The most fundamental covenants of God were given to our first father, Adam, repeated to Noah with some more details, repeated to Abraham with some more details, repeated to his son and grandson, Isaac and Jacob, with more details, and then repeated to their descendant, David, king of Israel, with even more details, and then finally were fleshed out in David's descendant, Jesus Christ himself. The covenants of man, and the most fundamental covenant of man is this: be fruitful, multiply, and fill the land. The land. We get to Genesis chapter 11, not very far from the beginning, and they said, we're not going to do that. They said, let's build us a tower. Let's build a tower that has religious significance and will tend to draw all men to one place, and we'll have a city. Well, God wasn't going to tolerate that because that mitigated. It was a matter of imprisonment by cultish religion. By the way, that's where the law of the city started. And by that cultish religion, God said, no, it's not going to happen. I told you to fill the earth. That means the land, that eretz, the Hebrew text. Cover the land, spread out. Cities are evil, spread out. And so false imprisonment, if the government, the powers that be, have the power to imprison men by the tens, twenties, hundreds, or thousands, God says, I'm not going to allow that unless there's a lawful reason. So in England, during the days of Magna Carta, before Magna Carta, probably beginning about the time of King Alfred, we don't know for sure, Alfred the Great, back in the 9th century, kings would send the justices out every 3 months, through every gaol, that's every jail in England, and those judges were to conduct an investigation concerning every person jailed in every place, and determine whether or not they were jailed lawfully. They were to look into the reasons for their jailing. And that was a duty of the justices of England. They did a lot of traveling. They were assigned to do that. Well, it got so it didn't work. Roads were bad in those days. They didn't even gravel the roads, much less macadamize them, pave them. So Magna Carta came along. They said, we got to do something different. And they tried to shore it up, and it didn't work. Well, then the legislature, later, Parliament, passed what they called the Habeas Corpus Act. It was ingenious. What they said was, every person that's jailed, or anybody on behalf of a jailed person, has the right to petition. That means to ask in writing. That's what a petition is. To ask in writing, to petition the court to issue to the jailer, the jailing party, whoever it may be, to issue to him an order, a written order. That's what a writ is. That's a written order from a greater, a judge, to a lesser, a jailer, commanding that jailer to bring the body of the prisoner in question bodily before the judge, and to prove to the judge that the jailing is lawful. And Habeas Corpus Act of Parliament also said, you can't do that if the judge isn't satisfied it's lawful. The law requires the judge to release the prisoner on the spot. None of this, I got to take him back to the jailhouse and process him out. No, none of that. On the spot. Because that put the control in the judge, and he had his bailiffs there or whoever there to enforce it and make the jailer do it right there. He couldn't, if you took him back to the jail, as they do in England, by the way, today, they don't even bring the body. They just have the hearing in front of the judge. They've abandoned habeas corpus. Listen, it's important that the body of the prisoner be brought before the court. You see, the word habeas corpus, old Latin word, I wish we should say it in English, it's translated, we have the body. We have the body, or we should have the body. It's in the subjunctive, the Latin. We should have the body. It's a command. The judge is saying to the jailer, hey, I should have that body, not you. Bring that body over here, the body of that prisoner. And that way he can look at the prisoner. Then he can hear also arguments from the prisoner, you see. The prisoner's not there. Listen, here's another thing about our common law that's unwritten. Our common law is an oral tradition. You can't have a public trial unless it's oral, and they don't in most countries. It's all written. It's on paper. It's more sophisticated. And It's secret. That's the nasty thing. That's why our Constitution says every trial shall be public in the federal courts. Public trial means everything's open, everything. It's the stuff they're doing now, sealing documents. No. The disinfectant of sunlight, our forebears knew this, is what cleans things up, keeps people honest. You let people, let the powers that be do what they want in private and have tribunals in secret. They'll be jailing people you'll never hear from again, like they did in Russia for years, and the gulags, people just disappeared. And they had, because they were under the law of the city, the code of Justinian. All communist countries have been under the code. Well, that's what habeas corpus is. We should have the body, the court says. That's a writ saying we should have the body, not you. And that right, it is said, will never be suspended. And that writ, called the writ of habeas corpus, you can petition the court for it, our common law has always called, since the days it was passed, or Parliament passed it, has always called it the great writ. The great writ. You see, every branch of government has a duty, a common law duty, every person in every branch, to recognize true law and to try to reinforce it. Our legislatures have a duty to do that. When they do it, when they pass legislation, their duty is to make sure it is consonant with the common law or enforces it. In the same way with our courts, in the same way with our president. That's habeas corpus. We should have the body, says the court, not you.
Okay. So then you said that you take that before the judge. Well, there seems to be a little bit of a problem with that when the judges nowadays have selective hearing or they're deaf.
Well,
when it comes to anything, you know, say just like if you challenge the jurisdiction of a court nowadays, they just said, we have jurisdiction, amen, you know, but even their Supreme Courts say that they can't just state they have jurisdiction. They must prove they have jurisdiction, and they must, it's called the order of the court, and when you request the order of the court, that's just simply pushed aside and bypassed. And so the courts just say that you are a citizen of this state, and you are going to obey our laws and their colors of law or whatever, you know, and there is nothing more you can say about it, and they just proceed without question. And we went through that here last Friday with one of their kangaroo courts or trials, and which I chose not to participate in. And so that's why I was wondering about this, that if I've got to take this in front of a judge like I just been in front of, I'm going to accomplish nothing.
Well, you make a point, and that's why Paul the Apostle says, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 through 6, why are you, and now this is in the civil realm, not the criminal realm, the non-criminal, but he says, why are you dragging each other before these Roman tribunals? Are you crazy? These people don't know anything about law. All there is there for their own selves. You're not going to get anything out of it. And he said, you need to establish your own courts. You need to impanel your own juries. And you need to settle disputes between yourselves. Again, I hasten to add, it wasn't a criminal jurisdiction. But here's the remedy, the only remedy that I can see, and I just offer my my point of view after rendering up here and thinking about it for a number of years. I may change, but right now I'm thinking this. Every time you go into court, if you have to go for whatever reason, and you offer up to a judge, lawyers do this all day, offer up to him, here's what I think ought to be done, and the judge refuses it, every time you do that, he piles up trouble for himself. You can't break, if you're right, if you're pushing the first principles of God's law, and you're saying, here, judge, is what we ought to do, every time he rejects that, he builds up problems for himself. I can't change that. I can't do anything about that. That's not my jurisdiction to do anything about. Let me just add something else to talk. This comes down to education. Judges need to have learned the law when they were young. They needed to have the mindset built into them. Who controls the education system, by and large, in America? The government, the powers that be. And education institutions only exist for one reason. One reason and one reason only, and will never exist for any other reason. They exist to give meaning to particular facts. That's all they exist for. And if you go to, for example, to a Christian school, and they don't have this idea, most of them don't anyway, but they're supposed to teach that all facts are given meaning by God himself, the creator of fact. But the government schools are never going to teach that. they have a religious point of view too, and their religious point of view is that the government's all powerful. They control economics. Abortion is a good idea. Freedom of speech and freedom of keep and bear arms is subject to the will of the people, whatever that means, 51% majority or something. That's the madness that judges sitting on the bench grew up with. You have to understand that, and I'm sure you do. But once you do, then you say to yourself, I see the only remedy to this problem is for me to do the right thing, me to do the right thing, always. And you can complain about the judges, but it's not going to change the judges. And the only way to deal with that is to understand and know what God wants you to do in the face of such things. If they're lawless, what are you supposed to do? I come back to some fundamental things. The only remedy to lawlessness is law. And I have to say of myself, do I really know? Am I really conversant with the two volumes of God's will that he's given me called The Laws of Nature and The Laws of Nature's God? And do I really understand what to do in that particular situation? Now, one thing we can do, that's why, of course, our Constitution guarantees the right to petition. Can you petition the court? Well, we're supposed to be able to do that. And it doesn't guarantee us the right to always get the right result, but it does give us the right to petition. I say again, as I said in the beginning, if the courts are open, that's our responsibility, is to instruct the courts, instruct them. That's what lawyers try to do all day long. If they're doing their job, is instruct the judge. I've heard judges come out and say on about some subject that is before the court, I don't have a clue about this. I've never done a case like this. Does anyone of you fellows out there know anything about this? And then they start talking and try to find out what the law is. Of course, judges want people to help them make decisions, to give them an understanding of the law. And we have the opportunity to do that. But I would say to non-lawyers, and lawyers too, but non-lawyers even more so, when you go into court, don't get caught up in the minutia of complicated things. Judges, if they've got the right mindset at all, they understand that stealing's against the law, coveting, lying, stealing, committing adultery and murder. Stick to the fundamentals. I saw a pleading one time. The first principles. Do you really know the first principles? I'm not asking you. I'm just saying all of us in general. How well do we know them? Do we know how they're categorized? Do we know the details that God's revelation gives us about how to apply the first principles? That's what we need to know, the first principles, and then begin to apply them. We really begin to understand them. But I saw this pleading one time. It was in federal court, and it was on an Indian reservation out west. It was in New Mexico. And a young Indian boy walking down the road, and along came a fellow by the name of Green. I remember his name was Green. And both of them had been hitting the sauce a little, and they were pretty well oiled. And Green wanted to know if this other one, I forget his name, wanted to ride. And he got in the pickup truck with him, and they didn't go a mile down the road, and they'd turned the truck over and impaled this one fellow on a fence post. Fortunately, it didn't kill him, but he sued Green in federal court for negligence. And his complaint was only about two sentences long, and a lot of misspelled words, but he said, I thought Green could drive. I remember that was one of the sentences. He thought Green could drive. He found out that wasn't true. But what he said on the pleading pretty much got the point. The judge took the case, and I don't know what happened after that, but it was litigated. I don't know whether a lawyer was assigned, but I know it was litigated. Apply that to yourself. I talk to you. I can tell you're an intelligent man. You're just as smart as anybody else. And don't get caught up in the minutia. Judges are sick of minutia. And when somebody who's not a lawyer tries to get in front of the court and play lawyer, that makes judges really mad because it's nauseating to them. They're tired of lawyers. If there's anything judges get weary of, oh, they like to have them in court, but lawyers get caught up in minutia too. Now, a good lawyer will be brief also, but maybe with a little more guidance because he's been in it a long time. But that'd be my encouragement to people. Stick to the first principles. I'm so glad, I think it was Paul a while ago brought that up. You need to do that when you're in court, and don't expect the judge to take your duty. The judges are paid $160, $170. I don't know how much they're paid. A lot of money, different states, different amounts. And they're paid to make those decisions. Sometimes judge asks me, well, Mr. Winters, what do you think I'm supposed to do? And my response is always the same. Judge, I'm not paid the fat salary you're paid to make that decision. I'm just here to make the arguments. And if you come in with that kind of an attitude, I suspect you'd probably get further than you would otherwise. Mm-hmm. Well, again, that's a lot of talk. I hope what I've said is worth something someplace.
Well, where can someone get help to go through all of this sea of paperwork that has to be put in to do anything with these courts?
Contact me through email. I don't run the email, but the message will get to me. And if you can, if you're up to doing this, provide a telephone number, and I could call you and we can talk.
Okay.
Maybe I'd know somebody. Maybe I'd have a suggestion. I'd want to know more about what you're doing.
Okay. Yeah, what's your email, Brent? Give them your email.
Oh, the email, shucks, I don't even know if I know what it is, John, because I know it's just on the website. You go to the website,
okay. And
because I don't maintain the website, I know that it says contact. You can go to a contact page, and you can just put your email in there and send it, and they'll send it to me. I'll get it.
Okay, gotcha. Ed, you go over to commonlawyer.com.
Yeah,
right.
And then click on contact, and it's just a form on the thing, and it goes to him. So, and you can send whatever information you can to him, and he can give you a call or whatever the case may be, okay?
Sure, you bet.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Okay, all right, well, we'll move on, Brent. Appreciate your time and your teachings out here, and we'll see you next week. You're welcome.
Thank you, John.
And if you want to pipe in at any time as we're going on, you feel free to do that. Gerard, are you here? You ready to take control of the controls?
I'm here.
Okay, you hit the next button. I won't. People might want to hit *6 to get into the queue. We only got about 3 people in the queue tonight. Usually it's crowded, but *6 to get into the queue. Gerard, you got it. Just click.
Okay, next caller, 2005, the last four. You can unmute it. What's your name and state there?
Jan from Kansas.
Okay, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. Yeah, I just wondered, when we see just an ordinary person out here, we see that something has gone wrong. For instance, I saw the 18 U.S.C. codes about the officials in our city when they're not bringing forward in proceedings, say in a city council meeting, if something comes up, which this has happened to me, so that's why I'm asking. But I gave testimony about something to do with the police at 2 city council meetings, and in one of the city council meetings, it's just mentioned that I was there, and then in the other city council meeting where I gave full testimony before the entire city council, it's completely been left off of that city council meeting minutes, or of those minutes. And also, as well, the incident that happened here, which was a horrible crime, is not on the record. It's not on public record. At first, it wasn't on public record at all. And then when I called the news media, two of our TV stations around here, then I started seeing a lot of police after that. You know, everywhere I went, there was police. What they gave me was a one-paragraph suspicious activity report. So my point is that even though a heinous crime was committed out here, and I've been dutiful to try to report it, it still doesn't show up on public record. Okay, now to me, here's my point. To me, that is keeping things that should be on public record off of public record, and I'm about ready to deal with that because I've been to the city hall and talked to the city clerk about why none of this shows up. And what I wanted to know is what would I be doing next? I mean, do I write them a letter and say everything that I just said tonight and then quote the United States Code that I feel like might be violating? I mean, I just don't know, you know, where to stop and when to go, and I'd like your advice on it.
Okay, well, look, first of all, when you're in front of a city council and you're talking, there's somebody taking minutes. And usually that could be a secretary, it could be the town clerk if you have a clerk. And I was on a town board, so I'm very familiar with those kind of proceedings. And we used to have battles with the town clerk because she wouldn't put things on the record. and when you questioned her, she would quote a law that says that she has the right to write things the way she heard them, and she doesn't have to put everything down. Well, there's a defense against that because they tape all those hearings, and you can request a copy of that tape within so many days or hours, and I would do that if I were you. Now, if you're reporting crimes to them, and they're elected officials, they have an oath of office, they have a duty to do something about that. But standing up in front of a city council, they don't consider that an official reporting, really. I mean, if you made it and went down to the police and you swore it in, that would be different. I mean, yes, you're making a complaint to your city council, but you're doing it orally. I mean, if you really want it to stick, you should write it. Hand them your affidavit. And,
okay.
You know, and I mean, if it's a crime, you should fill out a report to the police. You should go down with your affidavit, sign the complaint. Then it's official. You see, because you're orating it, and you're in, even though you're in the public, they have the ability to twist what you say or leave things out, and they'll even quote laws that'll tell you why they can do that. So, number one, ask for the tape. Number two, if it's really serious, make an affidavit and turn it in. I think you'll get better results that way. You know what I mean? Because it's more official than just saying it, you know, orally. Because you're not sworn. You don't have to tell the truth when you say something, and they don't have to hear it the way you said it. Once you're sworn, that makes it official. So if it's important enough for you to swear on it, then they'll take notice and they'll answer it probably. So that would be my next step.
Well, this happened 3 years ago, which I know that's bad, but I was taking care of my mother at the time. And what happened, I'm in Bonner Springs, Kansas, and what happened was somebody beat my gas meter out of the ground at ground level, and there was spraying, it was in the middle of the night, and spraying gas out into the neighborhood. And it's my gas meter was protected and still is by a real old mailbox pole where nobody could back into it the way that it was damaged. And it just seems like that I'm not going to give up on this because it needs to be on public record. And so I don't know whether I can still get an audio at this time or not, but I think I might just still file an affidavit anyway. And another thing that I need to tell you guys is that I have talked to my representative, United States Representative Kevin Yoder, and he did nothing. And then our state senator here, Steve Fitzgerald, he really paid attention to what I was saying, but I can't get this on the record, and it just bugs me, you know, that something that's heinous, that is that heinous, that it's potentially fatal. I was asleep in my home when it happened, you know, and that they would keep this off the record as many times. I've given my testimony 5 times, but I didn't write an affidavit. So is it too late at 3 years to do that and pursue this?
Well, I don't know that you're going to find those records 3 years later. I don't think they have to keep them that long, to be honest with you. You know, anything that they put on the write on the record, they have to save for a longer period of time. You know, it gets put in the record. You know, it's hard to go back 3 years later because people forget. They don't want to deal with it. And I don't know. You know, the best you can do is make a sworn affidavit and swear to it. But, you know, if there was no loss of life or limb or anything like that, they pretty much get away with not reporting things if nobody's complaining, you know what I mean? I mean, it was a potentially fatal thing, but nobody got hurt. So they don't mind shoving stuff like that under the rug. It was probably one of the councilman's kids or something. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, as long as there's nobody laying in a hospital bed that needs to be restituted and made whole, they'll get away with it because they're in control of things. So I don't know.
Okay.
You got to ask yourself, do you want to win or do you want to fight? You know what I mean? You got to pick your battles. And in the future, it's like a kid. If you don't discipline a kid immediately at the time that it happens and you come back later, they may not even remember what you're disciplining them for. It loses its effect. You know what I mean? You can't punish Johnny 2 months after he did something. He won't even remember what he did. And the government.
Well, I just, excuse me. I just think this is so, it was so awful that it should have been on the public record, and I don't think they have. If they have a right to keep things like that off of the public record, they shouldn't have it. And I'm right now, like I said, I was taking care of my mother, and I was unable to devote all the time to it that, you know, would have been necessary. And but I still think our community has the right to know that not only did somebody in our community think it's okay to do that, but that our police think it's all right not to report it. I mean, that's just, it's been 3 years, but I still can't get over that. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I will just have to pick my battle and go ahead and have the fight, you know, even if I win or not.
Well, I know police keep really good records. My goodness, God forbid somebody calls them to your house. They write it down as an incident and it's there forever.
Yeah.
They'll pull it up 8 years later and they say, oh yeah, there was an incident back in, you know, 2000.
Yeah.
Something. So they got records if they show up to something. Believe me, they do. Now that's the police.
Okay.
That's the police. That's not the city council. Whenever a police officer gets put out to something, they have to log it because they're strictly monitored. Now, whether they call it a disturbance, whatever, you know, if they got called out and you made a claim that somebody broke it because they were mad at you, now that's a crime. That's a different story.
Yeah, I did.
So,
well, anyway, I won't go into all the details.
Look at it. If you should have signed a complaint, they can't bury that. Once you sign a complaint, that's like what we're doing. When we put papers on that conveyor belt of due process, they have a duty to make sure that it goes through whatever the process is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if
yeah,
you
okay.
made an official complaint and you actually sought, look, just by calling, that's a complaint. They're supposed to keep a record of it. But normally, a good officer, if you're there saying somebody did this, they're mad at me or whatever, he's supposed to take your words down. That's your affidavit.
Well,
you're
yeah.
supposed to sign it. He's supposed to witness it. That's a complaint. If you,
I didn't do that.
Did
no, because I thought they were. I thought they were going to investigate it. So I didn't know who would do it. You know what I mean? So
right.
You know, I think. Yeah, I don't want to take up all the time tonight, but I really appreciate what you've said, and I'm going to continue. I think I will go ahead and write the letter and tell them that to cover up proceedings. You know, because in the USC that I got off the website, the Title 18 USC, I can't remember the other numbers, but it said that public proceedings, even in villages and towns, are they're the property of the public. And so, you know, and that to destroy them or mutilate them or tell somebody else to do that is a crime. So, I
yeah,
don't know.
And you're right. You're right. They're not supposed to. But according, you know, how do they write it down, though? How do they report it? You know, and the
yeah.
clerk has a certain amount of leeway as to what she heard
right.
and what she actually puts on the record. That's where
well,
that tape is important.
Yeah.
But anyway,
she
you kind of get the message. I want to move on. We got a lot of people waiting.
Sure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Okay, next caller says Mary from Massachusetts.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Gerard. It's Mary Carmel from Massachusetts. Hi, John. Hi, everyone.
Good to hear from
you. Yeah, good to talk to you, too. I just had, I wanted to go back to what Brent said about provocateurs, and it's a little bit of a loaded question, but I wanted to know what you people thought of the International Court of Justice, and I asked that because I don't know a lot about it, but I asked that because I'm referring to, I covered the story with Texas when they got raided last year, and I recently had heard the senators speak, and they're going through the International Court of Justice to be recognized as a republic, and they have, of course, a very unique case from the rest of us because they never annexed their land to the feds, and they have their own treaty with Mexico, blah blah blah. So they're doing that. But I was wondering if we have all of these provocateurs, this de facto government in D.C., and we're running up against roadblocks, and we know that our government is just fine, that we just have been hijacked in D.C. by these usurpers. What would stop us from going and taking our case to the International Court of Justice? Because we are a republic. We are intact. And we just can't get them out of there. And they're bringing all this foreign mercenaries in that they want to bring the UN in and everything else. Just wanted to ask.
Well, I'm not so sure that the International Court of Justice wouldn't work into that either. You see, we have all the tools to fix ourselves. We don't need to go outside of our country. Our forefathers were very careful to give us all kinds of tools, one of them being jury nullification, you know, recall. There's all kinds of things that we've forgotten. You know, the tools are there. We just have to pick them up. I worry about an international court of justice because, like Brent says, there's no country in the world that has the laws like we have under God. They're all based on laws of men and the ideas of men. And they don't have that guiding light to keep them straight like we do. And so when you have an international court, I'm not saying that they can't do the right thing. But the trouble is when you lift them up and you give them authority over our sovereignty, that's a problem. You see, we have to stay sovereign unto ourselves. We have to maintain the ability to govern ourselves. If you got to go outside of this country to get authority and enforcement, that's a sad day. Now, If the government ever broke down to the point where we were at a civil war, you know, like a revolution, and we went to another country to, like our forefathers did, and they went to different countries to get funding for the war, and those countries funded us because, you know, they figured enemy of my enemy is my friend, and they funded us. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? Where you take on allies or you have some other country that supports you. But to actually come in and say that they're going to have some kind of authority over our public and our public officials, I think is a very, very dangerous place to go. And not only that, we don't need it because, look, just with habeas corpus, it's a matter of the people picking those things up and carrying them into the courts and making them work. And they will work when the people show up there and they amass. Let me tell you what, you turn the lights on, what do cockroaches do? I'm telling you, these courts...
They flee.
Exactly. So by showing up in the courts, what you're doing is you're turning the lights on. So that's our plan. And right now, I cannot advocate an international court. I have a problem with that. See it? And what we've found is that there's other factions in there that have cleaved onto that. You got factions from the Vatican and factions from here and factions from there. It just is a very sticky thing that I don't think it's necessary. And we have so many tools at our hand that we haven't even begun to use yet.
I agree with you. I agree with you on that. I'm not saying right now. I'm saying that down the road, if things get really sticky, because
There is a reason to work internationally, and one of the reasons is that America was always the light of the world. You know, everybody got a fractional reserve of the freedom that we have. They're not going to get more freedom than we have. They get a piece of the freedom we have. We're the light of the world, and we're losing that now. Our light is getting dim. So it's very important for us to raise that back up because I don't know how much longer it's going to be, but the dollar was the world's reserve currency. So whatever we do affects everybody else in the world. And when we keep printing money and we make inflation, we don't just affect America. We affect every single dollar, ruble, yuan in the world. So whether you like dealing internationally or not, we are one world. The world has gotten smaller with communication, you know, with technology. So Washington said, don't be the policeman for the world. He said, trade with them, be their example, help them, but don't be the policeman. And what we do when we go out, we become policemen, we create enemies. They're not here attacking us because they don't like our way of life. They attack us when we go in and we do stupid things and we kill their innocents, their innocent men and women. And we fund the wrong sides and the arms go into the wrong hands and they end up losing their families. We have students over here that get a phone call. Your whole family was just obliterated by a drone. I mean, you talk about making homegrown terrorists. We're our own worst enemies in the world. We really are. So need to get back to those like Brent said, those fundamental principles, those first principles.
No, I agree with you. I just wanted to put it out there because I know that when Texas was stonewalled, you know, by the federal government. They wanted them to do everything through them, and of course they're uncooperative because they're not representing the people, and they're de facto government. And I think the world's pretty sick of them attacking every country around here.
Well,
and I just wondered, as a nation, you know, to reassert who we were, if they might appreciate the fact of us reasserting who we were, because of what's happening with GC, and the rest of the world is getting their wrath every day, you know.
Right.
But we in the 50 states, the people of the 50 states don't necessarily agree with what they're doing.
Well, I don't think the average person does, and Texas has been fiercely independent, and there are some things in its past that help maintain that independence. But really, the truth of the matter is the way this country was designed, every state is supposed to have the ability to separate if they want to. I mean, they join freely. They join, and yes, we are a union under the national constitution. And that's what makes us work good. You know, I don't agree with necessarily leaving the union and setting up another state, because then what do you do? I mean, do you establish free borders? Now trucks going from California through Texas, do they have to go through duties and tariffs? And, you know, are they going to close
right.
borders and all that stuff? It just creates more problems. Look, at this country works very good as a union that it is, if everybody would stick to those principles. That's, you see, they're getting off of the principles, and they're giving us this Justinian law, this corporate de facto law that is usurping our rights, and that's why people want to flee. But you know, it doesn't always pay to flee, because sometimes you end up in a worse spot than you were before. Let's clean up our own backyard and get it working again. And I mean, Texas,
no.
I think it'd be easier for Texas to clean it up. Because the people are fiercely independent. If they can get a good governor and they can get people doing the right thing, they could be an example for the rest of the nation. And look, they could keep the federal government right out of their state if they wanted to. They could separate pretty good, just the way the rest of us could.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I agree. We have our government. We have a great government intact. There's nothing wrong with it. We just, this DC machine has just been, with its tentacles, has been a problem. I agree with you, and I will keep getting that information out. I get it out every day, Gerard, about how people need to change their attitude, and that you know what you allow will continue, and we need to get into the mindset of they don't get their power unless we let them have that power, because
right.
they're not supposed to have it.
Right.
So I agree with you. I just wanted your thoughts on that, because if we get into some real trouble, because, you know, they're bringing all kinds of craziness in. I just wanted to ask, but I appreciate your thoughts on it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stick to our script, because our script, I know we have a lot more to do before we would even get there.
Well, you know, look, at the quickest thing is don't participate. You know what I mean? It's like St. Paul said, why do you keep going to their courts looking for justice? We got to stop asking the federal government. You know,
right.
that's the problem when we're asking them, you know, like Papa government, you know, in Patras. They're not our Papa. You know, we're the people. And we you know, they can say, well, we won't give you any more funding. Well, guess what? We won't send any either. How's that? How do you like that?
There you go.
So that's my answer anyway. It might be a little simplistic, but I think it would work. Anyway,
no, I'm in agreement with you. I just wanted to know what your thoughts were, because,
okay.
you know, right now our plan is we should stick to the script, I think. But I just wanted to know your thoughts on it. I did have one more little thing to throw out there. I wrote Kathleen again. I'm getting there. I'm about 70% through the civics course, but there's a three-answer section, and I wrote to her if she could just give me a shout-out. The second answer, it will take nothing from the answer bank. Nothing. So it's going to be a glitch.
Yeah, something's wrong.
Yeah, I get stuck at one point, and then I finally get through it, and then I was rolling along, and I'm at 70%, and it just will not take any of the answers from the answer bank. I got two of the answers out of the three correct, but I'm stuck there. I just love to finish this, because I'd love to take the Constitution course. So,
well, we'll see. Maybe it's something we got to get together.
Yeah, did you go to where is it? Go to free course and come down, and it's and there's a page where it says before you begin the civics course. Did you click on that? Because there's instructions on different problems you can come up that can clean that up.
Yeah, I did, and I've done everything. So
all right, then you got a hold of Kathleen.
Yeah, I did, and she did. She did get a hold of me, and she, when I sent her my info, I sent her the, also a screenshot of the second answer, which I left blank. And she said, "You didn't fill in your second answer," so I had to write her back and say, "I didn't fill in the second answer because two of my answers were right. That second answer, that the it's not taking anything from the answer bank. I'm just stuck there. It's a glitch."
Okay. All right. I'm sure she'll get back to you.
Yeah, I just wrote her again tonight, but I just in case she was out there, I wanted to bring that up. But it's great to talk to you guys. I won't take up your time anymore, and I just wanted to throw that out there. I think we should stay on the right path. You know me. I'm a worrywart sometimes. I shouldn't be, but I try to stay on the course. But, you know, it's a process. But, you know, I get a little bit nervous when they start bringing UN troops and trucks and things in here and set up sanctuary cities. So, okay, well, I'll just keep the course,
thanks,
John.
For the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, thank you very much, Mary. Okay, our next caller is 2412, last four digits. You've been unmuted.
Hey, thanks a lot for unmuting me. It's Donaldson Jeremiah here in San Francisco, Northern California. And I'm just to start it off, I just want to read this real quick. The various parts of a statutory enactment are understood in the context of the statutory framework as a whole, which includes the pre-existing common law, related enactments, and case law, and the Constitution. So that made a clear distinction between case law and pre-existing common law. And this is from an I have to omit the case name, but it is actually from either an article or a case that I downloaded from the law library. So, but I thought that was an interesting quote. I totally lost track of where I got it from, though. But pretty cool. Do you still have your guest on? Because I have a question for him.
Who, for Brett? Well,
yes.
Read the question. Go ahead, make the question.
Okay, here's the question. Let's see. So there is an enactment by Congress in right around the 1959 where they made available pensions, increases in pensions for I think it was actually, it could be 1859, but for people that participated in the militias and also in the during the Civil War. And I took a screenshot of one because I thought it was pretty interesting. And so one page says, the name of Benjamin F. Clarkson, late of Captain B.F. Cook's St. Clair County, Missouri Militia. St. Clair County, Missouri Militia. So they named the actual county in there, right? And so they also say that it's Civil War, and pay him a pension at the rate of $50 per month, okay, for his service in the Civil War. And why did I brought that up? Because I wanted to ask the guest if he could tell me what constitutional provision it is, right, that would protect our militiamen and the common law. The Unified Common Law Grand Jury, if there was an amendment that would do that, would he know that? Because, I mean, I kind of have an answer, but I want to hear what anyone else has to say about that. But from my viewpoint, it's actually in the 14th Amendment, and it's in the fourth section, and it talks about the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payments and pensions. Right? And bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion that shall not be questioned. So right here is a real crucial part, but neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, right, obligations and claims shall be held illegal and void. So as a common law, my point is this, and my question is this, leading back to the 14th Amendment again, would that serve to protect the militiamen, especially if they were accusing specific agencies of insurrection, rebellion, sedition, subversion, yada, yada?
Well, I was content to just listen to the talk and the discussion. And I heard my name, and I said, well, you did want me to respond. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah,
oh,
that
yes,
was directed
please.
To you, Brett, yes.
Okay,
yes,
well,
please.
The
awesome.
Well, the you brought in the 14th Amendment, and you brought in the Missouri Militia, St. Clair County, and the confusion that was afoot after the war between the states rendered our country, from all I can read about it, in a lawless state, more ways than we'll ever know or can, and we are still suffering from the lawlessness that came from the government declaring the whole country a military district, and like I talked about a while ago, trying to hang that guy in Indiana when the common law courts were open. And whether or not the militiamen would be protected, that's a question for the courts, and that means for the jury. I don't know. The militia clauses don't provide any of those details, and they don't even provide for the pay of militiamen, but they do tell us a lot of things we're not even, again, back to first principles. A hypothetical question such as you ask is it's something that could come up, and we should think about it, and I'm glad that somebody is thinking about such things, but those are questions that we haven't even got close to yet, because how many of us can even identify what the four militia clauses of the Constitution are? If we can get there and we can get congressmen talked into passing legislation to fulfill their duty, namely the training of the militia, so that there will be a uniform set of standards for arms in the militia, and then leaving it up to the state legislature passing legislation that would provide and declare what kind of weapon each man is to obtain and what kind of training will suffice in safety and marksmanship when the legislature has done that. And when the governor and the Congress and the presidents understand that the jurisdiction over the militia of the United States or any part of it, the governor within his state, the president, concerning all of the states of the Union, they have concurrent jurisdiction. All of the questions about payment and protection for their actions, those questions can be hammered out by the courts and the juries as time progresses. But, and I don't know the answer to your question. That's what I'm trying to say at the same
okay.
time.
Well,
that's for the courts.
Thank
that's
you.
Not, we can't speculate. And that's another thing our common law doesn't do much of. And maybe you've seen Perry Mason or one of these other Rumpole of the Old Bailey. Somebody will ask a question, and the other lawyer will say, speculation. And the judge will say, either uphold it or he'll overrule it. Well, we don't allow for speculation in common law because our common law is not a law of hypothetical questions. You can't even get to court unless your case is real, unless the plaintiff really has blood running down the back of his leg. That's called a real case in controversy. That's another common law doctrine that people don't talk about. People talk about the case overruling the common law. Allow me to take an opportunity to address that just a minute. Some court says that this case or some lawyer says this case has overruled the common law. No, it didn't. The Supreme Court of the United States says that Erie Tompkins Railroad case did away with common law in our federal courts. That's ludicrous. That's absurd. It's impossible, as I said a while ago. As long as we have separation of powers, as long as we have juries, as long as we have our rules of evidence, our common law rules, which we do have, and hey, true, Congress codified them back in the 70s, they're still common law rules. As long as we have the right to remain silent, as long as we have the right for crying out loud, a cross-examination, the engine, our common law calls it, of truth. Cross-examination is a common law creature. Only exist in common law countries. There's another one. All these unwritten things that people don't talk about, our common law is not this court, or whoever it was, said this, is misunderstanding. We all write and say things that aren't exactly right. I shouldn't be too critical. But our common law is not a list of laws. Somebody can't say, well, that overrules the common law. No, it doesn't. You can't overrule the common law. The common law is the laws of nature. It is not a list of laws. It is a way of life, a way of thinking. It is due process. It is the course of our common law, as the Northwest Ordinance puts it. So this thing about the militia, it's hypothetical. It's not a real case in controversy. It's good somebody's thinking about it, and I appreciate the question. I'd never thought of it before.
Go ahead, finish your sentence. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say the 14th Amendment is dubious at best to use as a standard. It's inconsistent with the fabric of our Constitution. And, of course, the question, was it really ratified, is pretty strong, as a matter of fact. And it turns our whole constitutional understanding on its head because it makes federal citizenship a function, or a state citizenship a function that's federal citizenship instead of vice versa. In other words, before the 14th Amendment, in order to be a citizen of the United States, that the first step was you had to be a citizen of one of the individual states of the Union. Well, that's not even recognized anymore, and that's madness. How can you be a citizen of the United States and vote in a federal election for president and not be registered to vote in your state?
Right.
That's what
they totally snuck this in there into the 14th Amendment, having nothing really to do with citizenship, but more having to do with suppressing insurrection and rebellion. Okay,
you hit the nail with your head, and that's what history tells us about. They were rabid crazy.
Why did I do that? That hurt.
Yeah. Well, it was just a figure of speech, but yeah, you did it. I have a written oath of one of my grandmothers, swearing loyalty to the United States, forced upon her. And, that was the madness that was occurring. The federal government was saying to people, either come in and take an oath to the United States or be arrested and imprisoned in a prison camp. And that was all over the country they were doing that. It was more pronounced in places like Missouri and the Kentucky-Illinois border. And you can read stories of it there, but I know it went on in other places. I've had read authors that said it. Well, all those kind of things were the part and parcel of the madness that was occurring during that mad time of evil. And it was evil. 600,000 dead men for what? For what? And then put the black man in a worse shape. And we're still struggling over
ahead.
All those things. Yeah.
That's true. We are. Actually, there's a lot of false racism out there. But I think that as far as the suppression of insurrection and rebellion, and how the grand jury goes about doing that. See, that's going to play a crucial part in our success, in bringing it in. And if there's really a need for the grand juries to take action, then we're going to have that also as a foundation, I think, because the actions couldn't be questioned. I mean, the 14th Amendment, 4th section, actually supports common law grand juries, is what I'm saying. I suggest everyone go and look it up.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Go ahead.
No,
thanks for answering the question.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll go to our next question. That was pretty interesting. Okay, we have Curtis from Virginia. You've been unmuted. Go ahead, Curtis. If you're there, you're very,
can you
very
hear
well.
Me?
Now I can. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. I was trying to say that I had gone through the Virginia Code here over the past couple of weeks. I do it every 3 or 4 months just to make sure that things are still what I think they are. And I noticed this last time I went through it that they had removed the 1-308 reservation, of rights privilege under the 8.01 1-308 reservation of rights. code that has always been there. Originally, it was under the USC and under Virginia Code, word for word. And I know that that had been has been there from the very beginning because I've been watching it. Originally, it was 107, then it went to 207, then it went to 308. And most of us are aware of that Title 42, U.S. Citizenship Reservation of Rights. But, of course, the court case from the Apache Reservation, I can't remember the exact quote on it, but I know that John has sent, we have sent all these things through the Quo Warranto, common law, in the past to all the states. And I just got the feeling that they realized that because of the Apache case, that we don't have to reserve our rights because that stands the sovereignty issue on its head. So I think because of those papers that we've been sending in, they've corrected that. They've taken it out.
Well, that's an interesting thought.
and
yeah. You shouldn't need the UCC to reserve your rights. I mean, that's
absolutely.
That's a first principle, is it not?
That's a first principle. And it bothered me at first, but I've been thinking on it and going back and looking at it, and I took it completely out of the UCC. Originally, it was in the Virginia Code, just like it was, exact quote from the Title 42 USC. Though I haven't checked USC yet, but I know that under the Virginia Code, they've taken it completely out. The remedies are now no longer under 8.01 UCC. They're above it. The remedies are above it, but it doesn't have anything to do with U.S. citizens' rights, as far as I can tell.
Well, my perception is that the UCC, they wrote that for themselves. They don't want us messing with it. They look at, you go in there, if you don't know what you're doing, you get in trouble. They wrote that UCC, and every time you start enumerating things, you get into trouble. You know, when they say there ought to be a law, and the next thing you know, they're making a marriage protection law. Look at, we don't need a marriage protection law. Marriage is an institution. We don't have to define that. We know what it is. The minute we start defining it, you can't possibly define it as well as tradition has, because you're going to lose. When you define it, you're going to lose. And that's what they were afraid of with the Bill of Rights. That's what Madison was afraid of. Thank God they did, because some people said, well, if you define them, then that's all they're going to give you. And believe me, that's what they will try to do. But the minute you think that you can do better and you can enumerate things, look, I don't remember who the king was in the Bible that wanted to count the people, and God punished him. He said, that's
David.
Mine.
That was David.
Right. He said, that's for me to know. That's not for you to know. And I think we all fall into that where we want to know too much. We want to number things. We want to define things.
Yeah, and
that's what brings us into this statutory business, because we're always meddling. Instead of getting to those first principles and letting common sense run each case on its own merits, look at, everybody wants to, they all want these IBM cards with the holes punched in just right and everything fits nice and neat. Well, that's fine if men were machines and we didn't have any kind of emotions or anything like that and intent. No, with a jury and a grand jury is supposed to look at those things that make the case different. What is the intent? You can't put intent in a statute. How could you describe intent in a statute? Because it's a culmination of many different things that bring you to that show your intent. It's up to a man and a jury and a group of people, you know, to say that you could define intent by an action and put the holes in the card and think it's going to work in every case every time is ludicrous. It's ludicrous, and I think that's why we get in trouble, because we're too busybody meddling all the time. You know what I mean? And of course, you know, the lawyers, they like to meddle, and a lot of this stuff, all out of this evil is brought on by those bar attorneys who know that if they put that stuff in there, they'll be able to twist it into whatever they want. You know, I mean, look, who was the biggest bar attorney? What is the meaning of is Bill Clinton? They couldn't even answer him. they didn't know what he was talking about. You know what Bill Clinton, what is the meaning of is? Well, is, what he's talking about the first principle. They're too stupid to know it. Because he said, when Moses went up to the mountain, he said, who do I tell him? He says, tell him who is sent you. That's what Clinton was talking about. Depends on what is the meaning of is. They wouldn't even go there. But that's what I believe that's what he was talking about. And they couldn't debate him on it. That's how stupid they were. I wish I knew what I knew now. Then I would have nailed them on it. But anyway, you get the idea.
Yeah, that's a good point. The other thing, Gerard, as I had while I was researching that, I had stumbled across the extreme rights, what they call extraordinary rights or extraordinary writs.
Yeah.
It was under the same section. And I happened to pile it on it, and I pulled up and said, well, let's see what they got here. And I had noticed that they had a section in there where they had said they had abolished the quorumto common law and established statutory quorumto. And I emailed that as soon as I got that to Jan and to Veronica, Nikki, and just and a few of the other associates here in Virginia to, you know, put that forth. I'm like, well, you know, my question is, where do they get the authority to do that? How does a statutory government eliminate the law of the land, which is a writ, according to the Fourth Black Law Dictionary, is a common law process. Where do they get the authority to eliminate a common law process? And I think I asked this last week, but you know, go ahead. That was my question.
Well, I don't know for sure, but I know that when you get into equity things, you know, that and you're doing things with that people contract into, you know, you can get away with a lot more as long when two parties agree to a set of rules. It's a contract. However, the United States has common law built into their equity courts. You know what I mean? Even though we have a judge sitting there and that's not necessarily a jury, a tribunal, you have a judge that makes the decision. He is the tribunal. And then you got some layers of appeal above him. But both sides agree that the judge should make the decision. So, you know, when they want to do something statutorily, if you and I both agree that this is the process we'll use, that would be okay, probably, right? Because it's an equity thing. We're not talking about unalienable rights here, really, unless you're taking advantage of me, because, you know, you can get to the point where you're going to ruin me financially, and then that gets into my unalienable rights. But and as far as an equity contract goes, we agree to certain things. I know that the mandamus is now called on Article 78. It's still a mandamus. It's still by what authority. But what I find is that it opens the door for the lawyers to do a whole lot more lawyering than if they left it a mandamus. That's the only thing I see, that they get into stuff that they shouldn't be getting into. Just, you know what I mean? So, you know, when you're asking by what authority you're moving, or we command, that's a pretty simple thing. How are you going to make a lot of money with that? Well, we'll turn it into a statutory thing and we'll talk about it for 6 or 8 or 10 months or a year or two. And that's what they do. And that's the only reason I think that they do that stuff, is so that the lawyers can make money. I can't see any other reason. I mean, what's more simple than a writ? And I do believe that they have to take them either way. We've been sending them and they recognize them. And look at, if they tell you, you can't abolish common law. Now, they've told us things like it's obsolete. Well, what does that mean? Doesn't mean it's illegal, unlawful, obsolete. If I want to,
it just means they're not using it right now. And I think my connotation is they think because the people haven't been using it, they just might as well go ahead and abolish it. Well, I'm sorry, but that ain't going to work.
Look, if I have a tool that's obsolete, but I can do the job with it, nobody can tell me I can't use it. I'm not going outside the confines of the job. Whether you agree that my tool is obsolete or it's not obsolete, I'm using it. I'm performing a job with it, right? So that's another trick word. It's obsolete. That doesn't mean anything to me. That's a non-statement, obsolete. You know?
Good point. Good
so,
point.
That's some of the stuff that we've run into. Okay.
Well, I had one more question. It's really more for John, I guess, because I've ran across a gentleman's material by the name of Richard McDonald, and you probably know him. He's been into the sovereignty stuff for, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years. He's got to be 90 years old now. But his issue was that if you have a Social Security number, then you're under Title 42, which binds you to the federal zone. And he's saying if you have that Social Security number, his view is you can't reinstitute the common law grand jury. Now, these are different
views. Yeah, but that's all fraud, so that's irrelevant. Look, if people want to use their Social Security number, fine. If they don't want to use it, fine. Whether you have it or not, that you can't lose your unalienable rights. They can't tell
Absolutely.
You that you're not one of the people. Look at the whole game that they play is a fraudulent game, so it's all irrelevant. That's why we ignore it and just go forward on common law. And look, at eventually their wall of resistance will fall flat.
Hey, they didn't tell you that when you took it out, did they?
No, well, see, this has been the issue with a lot of people, and they're hanging on to this babble. We've got all these people out here that are hung up, you know, on the fact that they think that they have to do something. But I'm with you guys.
Well, look at the other. Here's the other thing. Here's the other big problem that occurs here, because we go into courts. They find you with contempt. They'll do all kinds of evil things. They'll throw out your paperwork. They'll seal it up. They'll ignore you. They'll overrule you. Whatever they want to do. And a lot of these people, I mean, it's real naive to think that, well, okay, if I go into the court and say some magic words and click my heels, because that's what they're doing, you know, I'm a man of the land and this, that, and the other thing, that all of a sudden these people are now going to obey and do the right thing and respond to them. It's not going to happen. Matter of fact, the last person I heard about that brought up in the court that he was a man on the land ended up in jail. So it's not going to protect them.
I think they're just kind of being lucky. Some of these people are getting away with some of the things. I think it's kind of accidental, or the powers that be are allowing it to draw more people in. But I think they're doing right by maintaining the situation you are on these various groups that are trying to create these shadow governments. Because that's been the problem I've had for a long time. To me, my view has always been, you know, I didn't do anything to get put into this. Why should I have to do anything to change it? I'm the same man.
What you have to understand is basically that what they have done is they've corporatized our government. Our government is a trust. It belongs to the people. It's not a corporation. And yet they've corporated everything. They've incorporated towns, villages, cities, counties, states, even the United States of America. And now they try to say that we the people are corporations too. It's a game they play. So these people have come in and they've written laws and they've dumbed down the people. They've removed the curriculums from school. And it just goes on, and they demoralized us, and it goes on and on and on. But the whole, and then they've created this whole process of making money on everything. You know, you go to jail, they make money. They just make money on you every which way you turn. But the whole thing is a fraud, and a fraud is a fraud. Nothing has any validity anywhere. You know, it's once you move into this fraud, the idea that they're trying to do something in secret. It bears no weight in law. Now, it is true they've kind of got the guns. They hold on to the reins, and they've built this wall of resistance, and they put us in jail for contempt and so on and so forth. And sometimes you frighten them because they're not sure of who you are, what you know, and what you're doing, and maybe they're going to get caught up in something, and they throw you out of their court. That happens from time to time. But generally speaking, they're operating under fraud. And we've continued to put out the olive branch to these people, and it'll be there until they get arrested. The day they get arrested is the day that the olive branch is removed, and that day, I think, is coming soon. The bottom line is it's not going to stand. Once we get to the point of what's the word I'm looking for? Not saturation, but critical mass, okay? Once we get to the point of critical mass, and the sheriffs are educated enough and feel empowered enough to go forward, it's all over. And again, if they move quick enough to do the right thing and work with us and try to take, work with the people to take these people out of power, and the people that are in power start doing the right thing, we'll work with them, and they'll get the olive branch. They'll get the olive branch. We'll give them the mercy. And we'll, ultimately, look, we're not here to put anyone in jail. We're not here really to go out for vengeance or anger or any of those things. We're here to try to save the nation. And no matter what they've done in the past, if they're willing to work with us now, we'll forget about it. They'll get, they'll get immunity from it. Of course, if they've injured someone and someone comes with their injury, they're going to have to pay restitution. And restitution doesn't necessarily call for a jail sentence, of course, but, usually something must be worked out to restore the person that they've injured. But other than that, we won't go after them for sedition and things of that nature. All they have to do is just turn around and start doing the right thing and work with the people. But as far as any of the other stuff is, it's all fraud. There's no power and authority over us. It's just that they got the guns at this point, and they got their hands on the controls. But that's limited. That time, I think, is coming to an end.
Well, that's what I kind of like where you're at, John. That's the way I've always been. I didn't do anything to do this, so why should I have to go out of my way to alter something that I didn't participate in the first place? Their presumption of who I am and what I am has nothing to do with the reality of what I think I am.
Exactly. And for some reason, they seem to think by doing these things that you can give up your unalienable rights. Unalienable means that it's not transferable. You can't give it away. No one can take it away from you. It's there. You may not exercise it, but the moment you decide to exercise it, you exercise it. Look, take all these things going on with, let me think if this is a good example. I'm thinking of the mortgages. I'm not sure with that. But look, sometimes they make these agreements, okay, where you sign something and you give up a right. As a matter of fact, a mortgage, that is it. They claim that you've given up your right to fight this battle, okay, somehow, that you've given up your unalienable right to have your day in court. And that's not possible. That is null and void. As a contractor, I remember, studying construction law, and there was the AIA and GC, there was a negotiation, and you got these contracts. But some contracts in some places are illegal because it really should be illegal everywhere, but mostly because it violates an unalienable right. You can't put something into a contract that's going to lose your right, to be able to have that due process and whatever it is. They just can't take your property. You can't give up an unalienable right of due process. And that's what the mortgage companies do. They've created, of course, they worked with the Bar Association, which worked with the legislators, which created these laws, and they call them, a non-judicial something or other. Do you remember, Gerard? Non-judicial, I forget exactly what they call it, but these certain states where they don't have to go through any kind of a process, due process at all. And this has gotten so bad that whether the states have it or not, they're doing it everywhere. They just come in and they file the papers in the court, and it goes through a process of time. It gets a signature from someone, the clerk or someone in there, and then they move the paperwork over, and then they file some papers, and they do a sworn statement or an affidavit or something to somewhere to change the property over back over to the, you know, ownership of the mortgage company or whatever, you know, shell corporation they've constructed for that purpose. And then they go around and they then go to the town court and they produce the papers that they're the owner of the property and that you haven't been paying your rent, and they give you a dispossess. And then the sheriff comes out and dispossesses you. I mean, the whole thing is a con. It's a fraud. And again, the key to this whole thing is that you know, they claim that you've given up your right of due process, or I think it was the state declared the fact that you lost your due process, and they operate in a process called INREM, I-N-R-E-M, which right. is at sea, you know, usually in piracy acts, you know, if you know, you get a pirate in the act of doing some things, and you can seize the ship. And you don't have to serve any kind of a notice to the pirate because it's done in REM at sea. And they've moved that here, and they do that they do that in REM right there with the mortgage company. It's sort of a process of in REM, but particularly the tax foreclosures, that they outright tell you it's in REM. And again, it can't be done. You can't lose your right of due process.
Well, I was the only other thing that I've heard, there was something kind of odd that I heard, that your land, the land patents can't be corrected because the land is described under the Greenwich Meridian imaginary line, and it would have to be surveyed under the DC line. Is that
correct? Again, it's just the more magic words and playing words and just different things. Look at, you know, description of a land, it's you know, they do that and they mark certain points and they record the boundaries of the land, the surveying it and so on. You know, it is what it is. If what they're trying to say is that you have to use some kind of other point of reference, is that what they're trying to say? Some kind of other point of reference than
yeah,
what is being
used? Yeah,
it's
like you're putting your land, it's like your patents are not really on any land, it's based off of a sea location.
Yeah, like, well, again, I think they're just playing, playing games with it. Look, it's very simple. You don't even have to go to try to get any kind of a paperwork change. I know there are people that try to get your land back in order to get to deal with this title problem, and you have to go through an exercise of reestablishing and tracing it back and rewriting the boundaries and then tracing it back up. But you have to go back to the original parcels before the subdivision and all that stuff. And all of that is baloney also. The bottom line is just to claim the fact that you're in possession of that land. It's private property. Leave me alone. You serve the necessary people. Now, no one really understands that, and you're going to have to get it to the process at some point where you're going to take them to the court. When you take them into court, you take them to the federal court because you're violating, ultimately, they're violating the right of due process because they're taking your land in REM. I'm talking particularly about the tax thing. And so you take them into a federal court. And they don't want to go to a federal court. I've been in a federal court one time when I went up against the towns and the states and the county, and they have no clue. They're really nervous about going into a federal court, and the judges in a federal court, I don't know what's really going on there, but they seem to like to toy with these people. It's like a cat and mouse game. You know, the judge is the cat, and he's toying around with these guys as mice, and he picks on them. You know. Because and they don't follow the rules in the federal court. They're used to the lackadaisical courts that they're going into, and I think the judge picked on them far more than he picked on me. You know, he threw a few things at me too, but you know, these judges don't like people coming into the court. And you don't read the rules and how things work and so on and so forth. But the point is this, okay? These guys don't want to go to federal court. And if you sue them directly, which is another story, under color of law, because these are people executing things that are unlawful, so they're acting under the color of law. So you're going after the personal, you know, the people themselves. It becomes a personal thing. That shakes them up too. And you always got to let them know, I'm willing to walk away. Just leave me alone. Get me off your tax rolls because I don't belong there. And you could win just that simply, just by starting the process to go into a federal court and then negotiate what needs to be done. Get me off the rolls.
That's my goal. I just want to clarify that land patent issue. And the only other thing I had, and I think you partially answered it, is this Mr. McDonald's material had laid out that the state courts was common law, the federal courts, the Article III courts were not common law. And,
Article III courts are only common law. Go into the Constitution. Yeah. It's a clear thing. It is true. They hijacked it, but again, that's a fraud. It's only an appearance of things. The buildings are still there. Process and procedure is still there. A lot of good Supreme Court rulings are still there. The Constitution is still there. They may ignore it, but they're only lawbreakers. And again, look, it's anybody goes into court, first of all, you have to understand, how to navigate through the process and write some papers and really, put the point clearly on your paper. And I always go for jurisdiction and due process. It's that they don't have either. And they don't give you due process and they don't have jurisdiction because they're acting in chancery and not in common law. They're acting under the rules of chancery is what they're doing. And they get that ultimately from the Judiciary Act of 1789. And it really was focusing in on the equity courts. But even the equity courts were not to proceed under chancery. They didn't proceed under the common law. They had to go under American jurisprudence. And they have to go accordingly to that book, the American jurisprudence, Supreme Court rulings, and the precepts of common law. Now, it is true that in an equity court, you have one jurist, and he's a political animal usually, and he is a paid individual, a paid jurist. He's called a judge or a justice or whatever you want to call him. But he still has to – he can't make a decision on his own. He's got to act under the process he has to act under American jurisprudence. That's what he has to act under. He doesn't really get the chance, or he doesn't get the opportunity to make those decisions on his own. So he's got to follow the process of law, which is common law. Now, of course, in that particular case, you go to one jurist. If you disagree with the conclusion, you can appeal it. You can go to the appellate court or the court of appeals after that, or maybe the opposite, however that works. But you can appeal it twice, and each time you get more jurists that will look at the case and make a decision. But again, if our courts were operating lawfully the side of the court, which is usually the criminal side of the court, but also the civil side of the court, where people don't want to go into the equity side, they want a jury, so they're going through the common law side, which again both are common law, but at that process, when a jury makes a decision, unless they violated someone's unalienable rights, that's it. It cannot be overturned. The United States Supreme Court can't even second guess their decision. It's done and sealed forever. Now, of course, there are certain things that could be done, if evidence was withheld or something and the person was really innocent or whatever the case may be. But the conclusion is final, okay? But on the equity side, okay, it's not final. You can appeal it, and you can literally appeal some cases all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And from my opinion, And I know people say a lot of things, but this is my opinion, and I feel pretty strong about it. The United States Supreme Court has no business over thinking about anything to make any decisions concerning the rulings of any court that is operated by a jury, unless, of course, someone's unalienable rights was injured some way in the process of their decision. Of course, they have to protect that person. Other than that, forget about it. They have nothing to say. So they don't get to write law. They don't get to make these decisions. They're supposed to apply common law principles and American jurisprudence, just like the other justices. It's already established. And everything is really, in my opinion, it seems pretty simple and logical.
It is. And everything you said, I agree with 100%. And I've read that. And I was just going to mention, everything you mentioned here under jurisprudence, the jurisprudence books, under the headings of homicide, they go into the information about the grand jury under the homicide section. And a non-bar attorney gave a description and said it's the bar that's the cause of the problems concerning grand juries and the common law. And then on the other side, in the same set of books but a different volume, under jurisprudence, and that was under larceny, of course, a bar attorney wrote the papers and the documents from the courts, and he described the grand jury as a star chamber, like a dinosaur thing from the star chamber, and he actually used those words. So just right. Reading those two definitions from two different types of attorneys in the jurisprudence itself about grand juries was quite overwhelming for me.
I'm not sure exactly how things evolved to where they've gotten to today, but I know what you're saying. Look, a little while back, I was kind of ignorant on these things. I wanted to get a copy of American Jurisprudence, and you can't find it online. It's just not there. You got to buy it, you know?
Yeah, and I've got them. I have the set of 30, but...
You could throw 29 of them out. For my opinion, go back to my mm-hmm. opinion, because they've gone into a place that they shouldn't be. I ordered one online and in ignorance, and when they sent it to me, it was all about tax law and stuff. And look at the, and they're talking about property taxes and IRS and all that stuff. Look at the, there is no legal tax on property. There is no legal tax on income through the IRS, and yet they have a book and they call it American Jurisprudence. So yeah, it has really become distorted. But the main body, and I'm not sure how to identify it. I know Brent might still be here. If he's here, maybe he can kind of clear it up a little bit. But there seems to have been the main body of American Jurisprudence, which seems impeccable. And you can read through it, and it's just full of logic. And again, I've only seen pieces of it. I've never seen the entire book, or at least the volume that I'm talking about, that really gets down into the common law side of things, which I think really is a collection of opinions of a lot of United States Supreme Court justices over the years, and where they really have these really great opinions, like a lot of Scalia's opinions. You know, they're very well thought out and focused in on justice.
Yeah, his description of words is very refreshing when you can just watch his stuff on YouTube and on C-SPAN, and I try to copy those as much as I can. But I do have the 30-set volume of original jurisprudence, but like I said, it's only a 30-volume set.
And very expensive. How much did you pay for that?
More depth.
Did you pay for that? They're very expensive, I believe.
I picked those up on eBay, and it was a 30-volume set, including the index, which was 31 volumes. And I was able to get it for, I think it was $500.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good deal compared to what they're going for.
It had, some of their attorney had those, and these are based...
Yeah, well, what's sickening about that is that you actually... You know, I appreciate the fact that they have to continue, to update things, and that takes money and time and money. But nevertheless, look at... those kind of things should be accessible free. But you can't get to them online. It seems it's almost impossible. I'm sure you can get to it maybe if you're paying for some service where you can get in and look up court cases and things like that. Maybe you can get also access to that. I don't know. But nevertheless, going back, once we get onto the other side of things and we bring common law back here and we have the power of the jury and you have the administration and we're making sure that they're obeying the law, once we get to that point, then you can trust going into equity courts. Look at as a contractor, and I'm retired from that, but as an ex-contractor, I'd much rather go to an equity court get in and get out, then have to go to a court, you know, a trial by jury. The problem is they drag these equity courts out for half of forever, so everybody makes a lot of money, and you get drained out of everything, and it's not even worth going to court to get the money that you're trying to get off a client that, crooked you out of, so many thousands of dollars or whatever. But once you get, because equity court is, my cases, every time I've gone to court, and I moved it over to arbitration, I put arbitration in my contract so I wouldn't have to go to their stupid courts, because they would go on forever and ever, and they never ruled righteously. I know I wouldn't go to court if I didn't know I was right and I should win. And the cases are cut and dry. I mean, I think anyone that would listen to the case and is honest about it would agree with my position. Otherwise, I wouldn't have sued the people. And I could prove, I document everything. I could prove everything I'm talking about. And yet these guys, they just go on forever, and then I end up getting thrown out, or, you lose the case, or they throw it out for some reason or another, and it doesn't go anywhere. But really, an equity court, you should be able to walk in, lay out the case, cut and dry, an hour. In the case of a contract, generally, maybe a couple hours at most, going through explaining things, but it should be generally, most of them are very quick, cut and dry, 20 minutes, a half hour, tell the story, get everybody's sworn statements, and go back and forth with your questions on each other, and just get at it. It's done. But again, they drag it on forever, and I remember one of the last ones I lost was because the guy I was going after was an accountant. And he was doing the account. He was a friend of the judge. He should have recused himself, but he refused that. And he ruled for the other guy, and it was cut and dry.
That's pretty sad.
Yeah, it is.
That's pretty sad.
They also, as I'm sure most of us know, they don't like when you go to court without a lawyer.
You might just lose that way.
Right.
Yeah, every time I've gone with an attorney, and I remember the two or three times that I'd been in, I had it won until I opened my mouth. And that movie, The Matrix, really, really stood out to me on the last one, because when he says, when Neo in the movie, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but he says, why don't you leave me my phone call and I give you the finger? And he said, what good is a phone call if you can't speak? Well, that's what I remember. Every time I had my attorney, which I paid this attorney to represent me, and every time I wanted to clarify something, the judge would not let me speak.
Right. Well, you're an imbecile. That's why. You got a lawyer there. You got an attorney there. You're an imbecile.
I never understood that, John. During that whole period, but I remember all of these various cases I was in court, and I had it won until I tried to open my mouth, and then I all of a sudden lose.
Well, you're upsetting the con. They don't want it to get out on paper what's really going on there. In most cases and these things that goes on, everybody knows how the case is going to end up. You can go to traffic court, sit there, and how everybody's case is. Every once in a while you get someone that walks, but that is so extremely rare. Everybody's guilty, and everybody's going to get fined. They're already guilty. Why
guilty
even bother before, having it?
Yeah. Guilty, you have to prove yourself innocent. That's the statutory system. And I feel I've got a good handle on it. I haven't been dragged into court since I understand this. I get stopped by a police officer or a DOT guy, and by the time I'm done with him, he's off his high horse, and he can't wait to get away from me.
You got to be careful with that.
I don't have to fight them. They just don't, and I'm not disrespectful to them, because, I let them know that I appreciate what they're doing.
Right, but bear in mind, these guys haven't got a clue on anything. It's not even worth making the argument with them.
They absolutely don't. And all I've been trying to do is, in the process of talking to them, is to try to educate them a little bit. And I'm somewhat resistive. I will give you, because I feel like I have to. I feel like my resistance gets their attention. But it's not to be disrespectful. I always let them know ahead of time that I appreciate what they do. I think they're getting a thankless job. I don't think they get paid enough. But, I don't think...
Well, I think they should just close down their job positions, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
That'll make it simple. That'll make it much more comfortable for all of us, wouldn't it?
Sure, absolutely.
And when we get into the other side of things, we'll help them do that. It's a really easy process. Because all we have to do is apply the law, and they'll be shut down town courts, city courts, village courts, all those courts real quickly. You know, within a year, they're just going to go bankrupt. They're not going to be able to continue. You know, because to be honest, when you go into those administrative courts, they got to be honest with you. They can't hide the fact that you're contracting and your contract is set up in a fraudulent way that you don't even know that there's a contract. No, look at, hey, you know, they've got to be honest with you. You come into that court, they got to let you know hey, you know, if you don't want to be here, you don't have to. You can reject everything, then, you know, just challenge jurisdiction and you can walk right out of here. Well, who in their right mind isn't going to just say, hey, I challenge jurisdiction, and judge says dismissed? You know, when you're facing a $100, $200, $300 fine or whatever the case may be, you know, who in your right mind is not going to say, hey, I'm out of here? So they're not going to have anyone. They're not going to make no money. They're not going to be able to pay for the court. They're not going to be able to, you know, all the offices of the court and everything. They're not going to be able to pay for the police departments, because they make their money really by going out with the tickets, and it's just not needed. What we need is sheriffs, and maybe we'd have to add some extra sheriffs. They'd have to figure that out. But look at most of the crimes they arrest people for are no crimes at all. So
yeah, we need sheriffs that know what their job really is.
Yeah, I don't think that it is a an exaggeration to say that at bare minimum 90% of the people in county jails don't belong there. I don't think that's an exaggeration at all.
I don't disagree with that at all either. I do not, because I know a lot of these people are in there because there was no damage, there was the injury. And when every time I pull that equation up, there's no injury. Why are they in prison?
Uh-huh.
You know, and they're looking at me like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, well, there's no injury. Show me the injury.
I think it was Judge Bork that said 90% of the people or 80% of the people in the county jails are there because they opened their mouth.
Yeah.
You see, by opening their mouth, they gave them, they claimed that they gave them the jurisdiction over them, you know.
But, yeah, they make that false presumption about who they really are.
Yeah, but I think it's even gotten worse since then, since the Judge Bork case, because that was quite some time ago. Things have gotten worse. At least, you know, if we came in with resistance the way we do now, 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, we would win in court real quick. They'd want us out of there and just dismiss. Yeah, go home. Just go away. You know, today, you know, they're ramping up and they got the judge schools. They're trying to do strategies. If someone comes in and says this, you know, do that. And so they've got all these little strategies. So it's a little more difficult to get out of that process. But they know they're playing a chess game. I used to wonder whether they knew or not. They know. They all judges know exactly what they're doing. And that's evil.
They sure do seem to be more intelligent than what you tend to think they are, but they are smart. They know this stuff is what's going on, mm-hmm. what they're doing, and they just
absolutely
seeing it. And I would like to be able to try to. I want to try to put some paperwork together to try to see if we can force the clerk to give us the room in the court.
Yeah, that's for what purpose? For juries, grand jury.
Yes, for the jury.
Yeah, we've tried that on the state level. That's what we tried in the beginning. We tried a couple of different things, and a lot of other people have tried things too. We realized that's not the way we're going to get in. And we thought, well, okay, once we started moving into the federal courts, we thought it would be easier. But, you know, they're even more evil, in my opinion, than the judges on states. But
yeah,
they're slicker. And you have a better chance of winning in their court, though, than a state court, because they're much more intelligent. They can figure things out better as far as where you're going with things. And if they're frightened of you, if they're not sure, if they start to see that every time something happens in the court, you're able to, you know, make a point against it and land on your feet constantly, they start to get a little nervous. And when you start to, you know, put things into the papers to suggest very strongly that he better be doing the right thing, otherwise you're going to sue him too. You know, I think that starts to make him a little more nervous. Even though they expunge all these things, but I don't know, lately I'm beginning to wonder, you know, well, you know, right now there's a war on, the people against the judges, and the judges know it, and of course we the people know it. But there is actually a war between the judges and the people, and I'm talking particularly about what we're doing here with the common law grand juries, and they know that if we succeed, it's all over for them. So they're hanging on tooth and nail. They've got this real big barrier up, but they can't withstand the truth forever. They just can't. It's at some point they got to break. And so it'll happen. It's just a matter of time. So, but anyway, we're way over time. So, did we lose you? I think we lost the caller. All right, well, we've come to the end of our time. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And by the way, I wanted to mention this earlier. I'm sorry. Tuesday, tomorrow, anybody who's got a case with us as far as a habeas corpus or anything with a mortgage, we're going to have a meeting tomorrow right here in this room at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, 3 p.m. Tuesday, tomorrow, Eastern Standard Time, to let people know where we're at and what the status is. We've put out 25 papers.
John, it's 5 to 7 Eastern. It's 3 p.m. on the West. It's 5 to 7.
What are you talking about? 3 p.m. Eastern Standard. Right?
No.
Right. It's 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Everybody else has got to figure their time out to that.
The meeting they're going to have on the radio show with all the people, where we're going to discuss what went on with Doucette and that.
Oh, I didn't know anything about that. So, no, I'm talking about talking with people for the cases of habeas corpuses that we have.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And we started that back up again. You know, we're still busy with things, and we're getting, you know, tied up here or there, but we're going to start getting papers out. We did 25 or 26. I'm not sure if it's 25 or 26. Mortgage cases, they're out and done. And we do need to talk to the people whose cases we've done that on, because we have to let them know what the next step is. So we'll discuss that in more detail tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern time right here in this room. And again, you know, we do need assistance money-wise, so anybody that can give us any donations, we really appreciate it. And anybody who hasn't been given, you know, we ask that everybody give $5 or more a month. So please hit our donation tab and help us out. We got to pay bills. Got to keep the lights on. So, all right. Good night, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.
Once lost, but Thank you.